Blog Talk Radio.
We will not bow down to racism.
We will not bow down to
injustice.
We will not bow down to
exploitation. I'm going to stay.
Welcome to the Black Womaniverse. This is your host, Seek Wisdom. And Sister Earth is co-hosting with me today. How are you, sister?
I'm good. I'm good.
I caught the Holy Ghost
when we did that libation. I was doing a Holy Ghost dance on everything.
Yes, yes, yes. I am very well. Let me get some announcements out of the way first. We can be reached at our, or we can be, you can locate us at our website, which is blackwomaniverse.com. For everyone who's listening to us on Facebook, come on over and join us in the chat room. You can do that by going on to www.blogtalkradio.com/blackwomaniverse. And want to give some information out about our sponsors. One of our sponsors is DivineChemistry.com, and chemistry is spelled K-H-E-M-E-S-T-R-Y. And our other sponsor is MochaMango.com. And sisters, if you are interested in joining our temple, please make sure that you visit us at BlackWomaniverse.com. We have a lot of things there, study groups, books. We study any and everything pertaining to black women, pertaining to us being goddesses that we are, you know, and the gods that we are. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get into our topic for tonight. Today's show is We Speak Their Names. This is part one of a three-part series. Wow, We Speak Their Names. I wanted to do a show Sunday because I had been a little pressed to get some information out about some black women, because it seems to be that we don't have a lot of information out here and easily and readily available on the achievements and the accomplishments of black women in various fields. And so in doing my research on the women that I thought I was going to present, myself and Sister Earth, we were doing some research, and it started to be a bit overwhelming because there were so many women that we had never heard of before. I mean, never heard of before. And when you research them and get into what they did, you know, what they went through to do the things they did, it was just amazing. So instead of doing a two-hour show, we had to end up doing a three-part series, and this is just the first of the three-part series where we speak their names. So, Sister Irv, did you have anything to say or anything you wanted to speak on before we start getting into these different sisters that we want to share with everyone tonight?
The only thing that I really want to touch on is kind of piggybacking off of what you said. Like, once, you know, we, again, the sisters that we all know about, definitely they need their praise and due and things like that. But there are so many other sisters, and we're not talking about from thousands of years ago. We're talking about right here, day and age, 100 years ago to present, who have done some amazing things that we had no idea about. And I know, speaking for myself, I thought I was pretty knowledgeable, and especially, you know, American black history. But coming across some of these powerful, powerful sisters who did or created things that we use in our everyday life was absolutely amazing. And it also made me a little upset of the fact that these women are out here. This information is out here. It's hard to find, but it is out here. But just the fact that we are not taught that. So that it's just one of the things I wanted to touch on for sure before we got started.
That's a definite. A lot of information. All right. Just want to give a shout out to everyone in the chat room. I'm not going to mention names individually. But shout out to everyone that's in the chat room. Again, anyone who's listening on Facebook, please come over with us so you can chat with us in the chat room on blogtalkradio.com/blackwomaniverse. Wow. It's so many women that I had a hard time picking the sisters that I wanted to present today because it's just so many. You know,
that's why it's definitely going to have to be a three-part series. I can't even get into the amount.
I was just amazed at, you know, I'm going to just go ahead and get into one sister. And I'm feeling that song I started the show off with, Freedom. That was from the Panther soundtrack. And it had various artists in it, and the words, the lyrics, and the music. Listen to it. It's got a message in it. Anyway, I'm going to start off with Eliza Ann Greer. Eliza Ann Greer was born a slave, but became emancipated and eventually earned her doctorate. In 1898, she became the first African-American woman to practice medicine in the state of Georgia. Little is known of Greer's early life beyond her growing up in Atlanta. In 1883, nearly 20 years after her emancipation, Greer entered Fisk University in Nashville with the goal of becoming a teacher. She earned a degree in education from Fisk 8 years later in 1891 because she took every other year off to pick cotton and perform other work to earn her tuition to continue her studies. Shortly before graduating from Fisk, Greer decided she wanted to become a medical doctor. She wrote to the Dean of Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania requesting information about her tuition and the possibility of pursuing advanced medical education. Greer indicated that she wished to become a medical doctor because she could benefit her race more as a physician than as a teacher. She hoped for both admission and financial assistance. The college admitted her but did not provide any help, prompting her to revert to the strategy she employed at Fisk, alternating working and studying for 8 years until she completed her medical degree. Now, I want to stop there before I read any further. Let me make sure that I'm clear on what this sister did. When it says she alternated between working and going to school, that literally means she went to school 1 year, then for another year she went into the fields and picked cotton for a year to earn money to afford the next year's tuition. So, again, anyway, in 1897, after graduating from the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania, Dr. Eliza Greer returned to Atlanta, Georgia. In 1898, she wrote, quote, "Some of the best white doctors in the city have welcomed me and say that they will give me an even chance in the profession. That is all I ask," unquote. In 1899, however, Greer moved her practice to Greenville, South Carolina, where she specialized in obstetrics and gynecology. In 1901, she contracted influenza and could not see patients for 6 weeks. Facing the loss of her practice, Dr. Greer wrote a plea for financial assistance to Susan B. Anthony. The famous suffragist could not help her, but sympathetically forwarded her request to the Women's Medical College. It is not known if the college provided help. Tragically, after struggling for 8 years to become a physician, Dr. Eliza Ann Greer died in 1902 after only 5 years of medical practice. Again, Dr. Eliza Ann Greer. A powerful sister. Powerful sister, very powerful sister.
Okay. Are you done with Eliza?
I'm done with Eliza.
Okay.
Let me get the call-in number just in case there are people who are listening that want to call in to listen. What have you? Our call-in number is 646-716-7675. All right, go ahead, sis.
I just wanted to say again to reiterate the fact that she alternated 1 year of going to school with another year of picking cotton in the field.
Right.
That is amazing. And we're not talking about 1950. We're talking about 1800. She was a slave. So, anyway, I thought that was very cool. Okay, I am going to go with my lady. you already know what I'm about to talk about. Her name is Dr. Vivian Penn, and she was born in 1941. She's still alive. Currently, she is the director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at the National Institutes of Health. Her focus in this role is, she has focused her efforts on raising scientific community's awareness and understanding of and about the importance of sex and gender factors in basic science, clinical research, and healthcare. Her current major initiative is spearheading a national strategic planning effort of the ORWH to determine research and career development. Again, research and career development priorities for NIH Women's Health Agenda for the next decade include involving advocates, scientists, policymakers, educators, healthcare providers, and a series of scientific meetings across the United States. This is a heavy sister. That's not the only thing. In 1967, she was the only African American and the only woman to graduate from her class from the University of Virginia School of Medicine. She was also the first African American woman to chair an academic pathology department in the United States at Howard University College of Medicine. So briefly, she grew up, she was born in Halifax in 1941 and grew up in Lynchburg. All the city schools she attended were segregated. From an early age, Penn knew that she wanted to be a doctor, even though doctors were almost unheard of. She helped care for her grandparents, even administering insulin shots for her grandmother who had diabetes. The daughter and granddaughter of teachers, Penn's family encouraged her to study hard so that she could reach her goals. She earned a scholarship to Wellesley College and began classes in 1958. During her sophomore year when she was 19, her mother became ill. She had an undiagnosed bone tumor, and by the time it was discovered, cancer had spread through her body. She said, "I interrupted my career and stayed home with my mother and took care of her 24 hours a day until she died." She returned to college with even more resolve that she wanted to be a physician. She said, "I wanted to be the kind of physician who paid attention to my patients and didn't dismiss my patients' complaints, something that has really carried through and I think has been central to my way of thinking and approaching women's health." Penn graduated from Wellesley in 1963 and entered medical school at University of Virginia. As the only African-American and the only woman in her class, she began with plans to become a pediatrician, but during a summer internship at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, she became especially interested in research. Penn went on to complete her residency in pathology at Massachusetts General Hospital in 1970, while she was also serving as a teaching fellow at Harvard Medical School. In 1970, Dr. Penn joined the faculty of Tufts University School of Medicine, where she also served as assistant dean for student affairs. In 82, she moved to D.C. to become a professor and chair of the Department of Pathology at Howard University College of Medicine. By 1991, Dr. Penn was appointed the first full-time director of the Office of Research on Women's Health of the National Institutes of Health. Again, she has received many honors and awards. She was inducted as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1995. She received the Elizabeth Blackwell Award from the American Medical Women's Association, and that same year, Dr. Penn was elected to the Institute of Medicine.
Wow.
My lady. Oh, and on a side note, you know, I'm not trying to be funny, but the other thing I do want to point out, and Sister C, you're going to laugh, is that when I came across Dr. Penn in my research, I was looking at a lot of female doctor, black female doctors, you know, in particular. And, you know, all of them were beautiful and they're all right. But when I came across Dr. Penn, let me tell you, homegirl was not playing. Her hair is done immaculately. She is beautiful. Her makeup is done. She has a nice little suit. So I guess I point that out to let you know why I like her. She's beautiful. She's intelligent, stuff like that. But I don't know. I just want to tie that in. Like, sisters, don't let anybody make you feel bad about being beautiful.
That's right. That is right. That is right.
And again, her name is Dr. Vivian Penn, and she's still around. She's still the head of her department of the National Institutes of Health.
All right, let's see. Since we are on the sciences, I'm going to go ahead and speak about Jewel Plummer Cobb. She is a biologist. That's one of the things she's known for. But she's largely known for her work with skin pigment or melanin. She's a cell biologist and a cell physiologist. Jewel Plummer was born in 1924 and has encouraged women and ethnic minorities to enter the sciences. She's an educator and researcher, and she's contributed to the field of chemotherapy with her research on how drugs affected cancer cells. Now, Dr. Jewel Plummer Cobb became the third president of California State University. Fullerton on October 1, 1981. As president and professor of biology, she was the chief executive officer of the sixth largest campus in the California State University system. Cobb is known for her work in cell physiology, her promotion of advancement of women in scientific fields, and her activities on behalf of minorities. She has received 22 honorary doctorates and was a recipient of many awards, including the 1999 Achievement and Excellence Award from the Center for Excellence for her contributions to science and education. All right, let's see. Cobb was born in Chicago, Illinois, on January 17, 1924. She spent her childhood as the only child. She is from the third generation of the Plummer family who sought a career in the medical sciences. Becoming a noted cell biologist was a difficult role for Cobb because she was an African American. She faced segregation during the course of her education. Although she came from an upper middle class family, Cobb found that she had to go to black Chicago public schools. Cobb was in constant contact with African American professionals and was well aware of their accomplishments. She decided not to let anything stand in the way of her own success. Supplementing her education with books from her father's library, Cobb had access to scientific journals and magazines, current event periodicals, and materials on successful African Americans. Although her interest in biology could have led her to become a medical doctor, Cobb was not interested in working directly with the sick. She was nonetheless interested in the theory of disease and an interest that later led her to become one of the leading cancer researchers in the United States. As far as her academic career, when it came time to enroll in college, Cobb selected the University of Michigan. Due to the segregation of the dormitories at the university, all African Americans, regardless of their year of study, were forced to live in one house. In disgust at the racism still found there, Cobb left the University of Michigan after three semesters and earned her BA in biology from traditionally black Talladega College in Alabama. Cobb applied for teaching fellowships at New York University. Because of her race, she was at first turned down for the position. Cobb refused to accept rejection and personally visited the college, which then accepted her because of her credentials were so impressive. In 1945, Cobb started her career in teaching as a fellow there. In 1947, she earned an MS in cell physiology, and in 1950, she earned a PhD in the cell physiology from New York University. Her dissertation was titled Mechanisms of Pigment Formation. Cobb was named as an independent investigator for the Marine Biological Laboratory in 1949. She completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the Cancer Research Foundation of Harlem Hospital and at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. After she earned her doctorate, Cobb became a fellow at the National Cancer Institute from 1952 to 1954. She directed the Tissue Culture Laboratory at the University of Illinois. Focusing on skin pigment and how melanin can protect the skin from ultraviolet damage, Cobb looked at skin cancers or melanomas. She also studied the difference between normal and cancerous pigment cells. Her research looked at neoplastic pigment cells and their development, as well as exploring how hormones, chemotherapeutic drugs, and other agents could cause changes in cell division. She experimented with the comparisons between how chemotherapy drugs performed in cancer patients and how they performed in vitro, or in other words, in laboratory test tubes, flasks, or discs. 1969 to 76, Cobb became a dean of Connecticut College in New London, where she taught zoology. From 76 to 81, Cobb was a professor of biological sciences at Douglas College, a women's college at Rutgers University. She also served as dean. As she moved into administrative positions, Cobb used her influence to further the educational facilities and opportunities for those interested in studying the sciences. Cobb never forgot the years of frustration she faced discrimination when pursuing her education. To help pave the way for other minorities who wanted to enter the sciences, Cobb established a privately funded program for minority students in pre-med and pre-dental studies at Connecticut College. She was tireless in her efforts to extend opportunities to women as well. In her quest for equal access to opportunity, both educational and professional, Cobb sought to increase diversity among faculty and students during her time at Fullerton. Also at Fullerton, Cobb started a President's Opportunity Program for minority students. She recognized the difference between the number of blacks who pursue sports careers and the number of blacks who pursue research careers. So she set up teams of faculty members to tutor students on math. A solid foundation in math, Cobb believed, would help minorities prepare for a career in the sciences. Cobb spent much of her time trying to stop minorities on the path of sciences that she had followed. As a university trustee professor, Cobb worked with six colleges to find funding for minority grants and fellowships. When government funding for such programs was reduced, Cobb worked to find private funds to fill the void. Education, according to Cobb, is a key factor in determining whether someone will be successful and independent or encounter failure and have to depend on welfare. She maintains that one of the best pathways to success is education, and it is the route she took to achieve her personal accomplishments. She believes more minorities should have the chance to find their niche in society through education. Quote, there's been a deprivation of certain educational experiences that would give young people a proper boost and encouragement to study sciences and technology, unquote. Cobb told Black Enterprise, I don't think there's anything wrong with black children's abilities to learn. It is the matter of being stimulated, having a curiosity about science early on, and developing the commitment and discipline to study. And that is Jewel Plummer Cobb.
Wow. Another powerful lady.
Indeed.
Okay, I am going to get on, I'm going to speak on Bridget Mason, affectionately known as Biddy Mason. She was born in 1818, and she died in 1891. Bridget Biddy Mason, born a slave in Mississippi in 1818, financial success that enabled her to support her extended family for generations. Let me read that again. Achieved financial success that enabled her to support her extended family for generations, despite the fact that she was illiterate. She could not read.
Oh my gosh! There's no excuse.
In a landmark case, she sued her master for freedom, saved her earnings, invested in real estate, and became a well-known philanthropist in Los Angeles, California. Again, Miss Mason was born in 1818 and died in 1891. Although born in Mississippi, Mason was owned by slaveholders in Georgia and South Carolina before she was returned to Mississippi. Her last owner, Robert Marion Smith, a Mississippi Mormon convert, followed the call of church leaders to settle in the West. Mason and her children joined other slaves on Smith's religious pilgrimage to establish a new Mormon community in Utah. In 1848, 30-year-old Mason walked 1,700 miles behind a 300-wagon caravan that eventually arrived in the Holiday Cottonwood area of Salt Lake Valley. Along the route west, Mason's responsibilities included setting up and breaking camp, cooking the meals, herding the cattle, and serving as a midwife, as well as taking care of her three young daughters, aged 10, 4, and an infant. In 1851, Smith and his family and slaves set out in a 150-wagon caravan for San Bernardino, California, to establish yet another Mormon community. Ignoring Brigham Young's warning that slavery was illegal in California, Smith brought Mason and other enslaved people to the new community. Along the trek, Biddy Mason met Charles and Elizabeth Flake Rowan, free blacks who urged her to legally contest her slave status once she reached California, a free state. Mason received additional encouragement by free black friends whom she met in California, Robert and Minnie Owens. In December 1855, Robert Smith, fearing losing his slaves, decided to move with them to Texas, a slave state. The Owens family had a vested interest in the Mason family as one of their sons was romantically involved with Mason's 17-year-old daughter. When Robert Owens told the Los Angeles County Sheriff that slaves were being held illegally, he gathered a posse, which included Owens and his sons, other cowboys and vaqueros from the Owens Ranch. The posse apprehended Smith's wagon train in Cajun Pass, California, en route to Texas, and prevented him from leaving the state. After spending 5 years enslaved in a free state, Bridget Mason challenged Robert Smith for her freedom. On January 19, 1856, she petitioned the court for freedom for herself and her extended family of 13 women and children. Los Angeles District Judge Benjamin Hayes took 3 days before handing down his ruling in favor of Mason and her extended family, citing California's 1850 Constitution, which prohibited slavery. Let me skip to another part, which speaks specifically of her accomplishments. Okay, Bridget had no legal last name. After emancipation, she chose to be named as Bridget Mason. Mason was the middle name of Amasa Lyman, a Mormon apostle and mayor of San Bernardino. She had spent many years in the company of the Amasa Lyman household and family. Mason worked in Los Angeles as a nurse and midwife. Saving carefully, she was one of the first African Americans to purchase land in the city. As a businesswoman, she amassed a small fortune of nearly $300,000. Again, she was born in 1818, then she died in 1891, and she had amassed a small fortune of nearly $300,000, which she shared generously with charities. Biddy also fed and sheltered the poor and visited prisoners. She was instrumental in founding a traveler's aid center and an elementary school for black children. Because of her kind and giving spirit, many called her Auntie Mason or Grandma Mason. In 1872, Mason was a founding member of the first African Methodist Episcopal Church, the city's first and oldest black church. The organizing meetings were held in her home on Spring Street. She donated the land on which the church was built. She spoke fluent Spanish. Okay, she was illiterate. However, she spoke fluent Spanish and was a well-known figure downtown, especially at the old plaza where she conducted business. She dined on occasion at the home of Pio Pico, the last governor of Mexican California and a wealthy Los Angeles landowner. Mason is an honoree in the California Social Work Hall of Distinction. She is also celebrated on Biddy Mason Day on November 16th.
Wow. And yeah, we've gone over the information pertaining to these sisters, but still sitting here listening to it is like, wow.
Yeah, no. Like,
we've never heard of these people before.
Never. And we're in just like, I mean, everyone's accomplishment, no matter what time period they lived in. But I have to be honest, some of the sisters from the 1800s and the 1700s that we have gone over.
Yes.
You know, Eliza Ann Greer, the first woman to be the first African American woman to be a doctor in Georgia. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a former slave could do this. A woman amassed $300,000, though she was illiterate and couldn't read and spoke fluent Spanish and was a slave herself. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but
this is amazing.
We never hear about these sisters, you know, and I'm going to speak on this. You know, and if people get sensitive about it, oh, well, it is what it is. In the conscious community, we get taught about a lot of these scholars and a lot of these men who, you know, people contribute a lot of good works to. But we never hear about the wives that pretty much do a lot of the work in the background. We never hear about these women, and a lot of times some of the women that we are going to present, you know, in this series, a lot of these women, when you look at the conscious movement, they try to call these women sellouts. Now, how exactly are you a sellout because you went and did something your way to provide for your family and to look out for people of your race and your gender?
That's right.
And to me, it seems as though that's an excuse to keep women from not researching the works that other women have done.
Also, another thing, though, as well, is that, yeah, we can't – I want to point this out, too. It's in the conscious community, but it's
– And it's in the overall
It's global because while we did come across this information – if we're honest with ourselves, we really got a lot of this information from three different book sources that we could find, and then, you know, whatever Wiki had to offer, sometimes they didn't have much. You know what I mean? Like, we got kind of lucky with this information. So I think it's time, like, we know what they're doing to keep the information from us sisters specifically.
Right.
So it's up to us sisters to make sure that these women's names are spoken every day, not just today.
That's right.
You know, that our daughters and our granddaughters know this.
Exactly. Now, the thing that, oh, my gosh. Well, quite a few of the sisters participated in a opening of the way, if you will, prior to the show. And all I can say is
the energy.
Oh, my gosh, as we recall, as we were speaking their names, oh, my gosh.
Yes, yes. That's
oh
what I was
gosh.
Talking about when I said I got the Holy Ghost. Like, woo, girl.
I mean, woo. I was hot. I mean, I was hot because I was running around the house. But, I mean, wow. I'm still, that energy is still running through me right now. Just, I mean, wow. Woo. Okay, anyway. Now, some of us have heard of Maggie Lena Walker before, or Maggie L. Walker. Now, this sister is, I'm from Richmond, Virginia. I currently live in Richmond, Virginia. So I've known about this sister my whole life. But a lot of people haven't heard of her, or either if they have heard of her, don't know a lot about what her contribution was. So Maggie L. Walker, 1867 to 1934. Maggie Lena Walker was the first woman in the United States to become president of a local bank. She was the first woman, not first black woman, but the first woman to charter a bank in the entire country ever. She was born on July 15, 1867 in Richmond, Virginia. She was the daughter of former slaves, Elizabeth Draper Mitchell and William Mitchell, who worked in the mansion of the abolitionist Elizabeth Van Loo. After a few years of living at the mansion, her father got a job as the head waiter at the St. Charles Hotel, and the family moved to a small house in town. Her father was murdered, presumably a victim of robbery, and her mother supported herself and her two children with her laundry business while Maggie helped with the chores. In addition, Maggie attended the Lancaster School and then the Armstrong Normal School. After graduation in 1883, she taught at the Lancaster School until her marriage to Armstead Walker, Jr., a building contractor, in September 1886. They subsequently had three sons, though one died in infancy. She also became an agent for an insurance company, the Women's Union. Since age 14, she had been a member of the Grand United Order of St. Luke, an African-American fraternal and cooperative insurance society founded in Baltimore in 1867 by a former slave, Mary Prout, with headquarters established in Richmond, Virginia in 1889. The order had been established to assure proper health care and burial arrangements of its members and encourage self-help and racial solidarity. Walker worked her way up until in 1899 she became the executive secretary treasurer of the organization, now renamed the Independent Order of St. Luke. The order was in debt at the time, so she accepted a reduced salary of $8 per month. In 1902, she started publishing a newsletter, the St. Luke Herald, to increase awareness of the activities of the organization and to help in the educational work of the order. The following year, she opened the St. Luke Penny Savings Bank and became its president. The bank's goal was to facilitate loans to the community. By 1920, the bank helped purchase about 600 homes. By 1924, the Independent Order of St. Luke had 50,000 members, 1,500 local chapters, a staff of 50 working in its Richmond headquarters, and assets of almost $400,000. That was in 1924. So $400,000 was a lot of money in 1924. The Penny Savings Bank absorbed all other black-owned banks in Richmond in 1929 and became the Consolidated Bank and Trust Company with Walker as its chairman of the board. This bank is still open today in Richmond, Virginia. In 1912, she helped found the Richmond Council of Colored Women and served as its president. The council raised money for the support of Janie Porter Barrett, Virginia Industrial School for Colored Girls, and for other philanthropies. She was a member of the International Council of Women of the Darker Races, the National Association of Wage Earners, National Urban League, and the Virginia Interracial Committee. She also co-founded the Richmond branch of the NAACP. Walker suffered more personal tragedies in her life. In 1907, she fell on the front steps of her home and injured her knee. The damaged nerves and tendons contributed to her trouble for the rest of her life. She also suffered from diabetes and was confined to a wheelchair after 1928. Her husband died in 1915 when her son, Russell Eccles Talmage, mistook his father for a prowler on the porch and shot him. Russell was acquitted for the murder charge, but he never recovered from this ordeal, and he died in 1923. Walker died in Richmond, Virginia on December 15th of 1934. The cause of her death was listed as diabetes gangrene. Her house, the house her family occupied from 1904 to 1934, is now a Maggie L. Walker National Historic Site located at 110 and a half East Lee Street, which I ride by and visit frequently. There's a lot more for people to find out about this sister. She had a lot of contributions to society and to black people and to specifically black women as a whole. And as we start to read information regarding these sisters, you will see that it's a link. I'm not going to mention the links now, but just pay close attention to the organizations that these sisters are participating in. That's all I'm going to say for now. Anyway, that's Maggie L. Walker.
Girl, I'm going to put a picture of Maggie L. Walker on my altar.
I have a couple of these sisters that I have dedicated my business to. That's one of them. But the chief one is one that I'll touch on next time around.
Okay, the next woman, strong black woman that I am going to speak on is Dr. Lena Frances Edwards. She was born on September 17, 1900, and she died on December 3rd, 1986. I'm going to stop a couple places. You know, I am reading something. I'm going to stop a couple places just to share some other information that I remember about her and that I came across. Okay, Dr. Lena Edwards, she was born in Washington, D.C. on September 17, 1900, the daughter of a professor of dentistry, Dr. Thomas Edwards and Marie Coakley Edwards. Edwards' mother raised Lena and her three siblings in a Roman Catholic faith, leaving a lifelong impact on her daughter. Edwards graduated from Howard University in Washington, D.C. in 1921 and Howard University Medical School in 1924. She married a classmate, Dr. Keith Madison, but retained her family name. I would cut it right there. I thought that was pretty deep because, again, we're talking about the early 20s. And so she married a classmate, Dr. Keith Madison, but retained her family name. The newlyweds moved to Jersey City. In an interview, according to Linda J. Holmes, an article about Edwards, at a time when schools in Washington, D.C. were segregated, their decision to move to Jersey City was partially motivated by their search for integrated parochial schools. Edwards opened a private practice on Pacific Avenue in the Lafayette section of Jersey City. Now, what they're not saying in this article was that was at her house. Here, she treated poor and immigrant factory workers and their families who were residents in neighborhood housing projects. At the same time, Edwards began raising her own family of six children. In an interview about her early practice, Dr. Edwards comments, "I was in a neighborhood of people from Eastern Europe, like Polish and the Slavish, and they were used to women, especially for maternity cases. They would come to me because they could talk freely to me. I built up a practice fairly well, very well, as a matter of fact, in spite of the fact that I was having babies one behind the other." She also found the poor... She was getting it in. She also found the Poor Cachet, a professional and philanthropic club for black college-educated women, the first of its kind in New Jersey City. During her career in Jersey City, Edwards delivered over 5,000 babies. She began delivering babies at home and was an advocate of natural childbirth. When the Margaret Haig Maternity Hospital opened in 1931, Edwards became a staff physician but was denied residency in the OBGYN department for almost 15 years. After her acceptance in 1945, she completed the mandatory two-year residency and became one of the first national board-certified black female OBGYNs in the United States. Even then, the hospital demurred on an appointment in her specialization. She comments as follows on the delay. I am the only certified OB in the country without privileges in the Margaret Haig Maternity Center, albeit for 3 years I have met all qualifications except possibly race, sex, and age. Edwards was eventually appointed an assistant attending at the maternity hospital. She was named one of 13 outstanding women doctors in 1946, a fellow of the International College of Surgeons, and Woman Doctor of the Year from the New Jersey chapter of the American Medical Association in 1954. In 1947, Edwards chose to separate from her husband and join the Third Order of Franciscans of the Roman Catholic Church. In 1954, she left Jersey City and returned to D.C. to teach obstetrics at Howard University Medical School. Edwards also became a medical advisor for the National Association of Colored Women, chair of the Maternal Welfare Committee of the District of Columbia Urban League, and a member of the Catholic Interracial Council. But by far, her most extraordinary accomplishment was that at the age of 60, she interrupted her practice to do missionary work at Hereford, Texas, among Mexican migrant farm workers. She also founded a modern maternity hospital and named it after Our Lady of Guadalupe. Yeah, I knew you were going to get that one, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Funding for the 200-bed clinic came from her personal finances and contributions from her New Jersey supporters. After suffering a heart attack while working in Texas, Edwards returned to Washington, D.C., where she eventually joined with Project Head Start. In 1964, President Lyndon B. Johnson recognized her humanitarian work and nominated her for the Presidential Medal of Freedom. 2 years later, Edwards was back in Jersey City, where she started a medical practice with her daughter, Dr. Marie Meteor. I can't say that right. She was also appointed medical coordinator of Jersey City's preschool anti-poverty program and taught at St. Peter's College Institute of Industrial Relations until she retired in 1972. Among her 14 honorary degrees, Dr. Edwards' work was recognized by St. Peter's College in 1966, Jersey City State College, now Jersey City University, in 1972. She was chosen as a Jersey Journal Woman of Achievement in 1962. A playground on Pine and Johnson Street in Jersey City was also named for Dr. Edwards.
Wow. Again, I'm going to have to repeat something that you and I said when we were researching, but I think Shah Bless just said in the chat room, if these women accomplished all this back then when times were hard as hell for black folks, just imagine the things we could do now.
Exactly.
And my response was, this is why we speak their names. These sisters, by far, we cannot allow them to be forgotten. We cannot allow, you know, their contributions and the things they did, the things they accomplished, to not be spoken about. It's up to us to make sure their legacies live on and that these are shining examples of inspiration as to what we can do. Regardless of what field you're interested in, there is no excuse for not going for your dreams and, you know, going for all your goals, no matter what other people say, do the damn thing.
Exactly.
And the thing that I'm gonna touch on real quick is I find it interesting, very, very interesting, that all of these sisters, you know, you read books such as Carter G. Woodson's The Miseducation of the Negro, and in that book he speaks on the fact that a lot of people who go to these upper-class schools and when they go to these places, they don't come back to the community. Yet and still, when we researched these sisters, they specifically went to the best colleges possible, sometimes having to pay their own tuition because they couldn't get, you know, there were no scholarships available in most cases, you know, no assistance. And they went to these colleges and then came back to their community and their people and to black women to assist them. You will see this overwhelmingly. So there's no, you know, I don't even know how anybody can even say anything about a sellout.
Exactly.
And the reason why I keep saying that word sellout is because it bothers me that anybody would call, you know, someone of that nature a sellout because there's certain things they chose to do as a benefit to their people and to their gender. And that's all I'm going to say on that one. All right, now, I am going to speak on Madam C.J. Walker. You said Vivian W. Penn was your lady. Madam C.J. Walker is my lady.
That's right.
What'd you say? What did you say?
I just said, that's right.
Okay. Exactly. I'm reading, girl, you need to come in the chat room, Earth, because the chat room is buzzing. All right. Madam C.J. Walker. Madam C.J. Walker was the first black woman millionaire. Let me repeat that. She was the first black woman to become a millionaire. Now, the time that she was living in was 1867 to 1919. Now, let me repeat. As a manufacturer of hair care products for African-American women, Madam C.J. Walker, born as Sarah Breedlove, became the first black woman millionaire. This is why I have dedicated my business to Madam C.J. Walker. Okay. Madam C.J. Walker was named Sarah Breedlove at birth and was born on December 23, 1867, in Delta, Louisiana, to Owen and Minerva Breedlove, both of whom were emancipated slaves. The Breedloves worked as sharecroppers on a cotton plantation. At the age of six, Sarah was orphaned, and in 1878, the cotton crop failed and a yellow fever epidemic struck the young girl. The young girl moved to Vicksburg to live with her sister, Lavinia, and to work as a domestic. She worked hard from the time she was very young, suffering great poverty and had little opportunity to get an education. In order to escape the oppressive environment created by Lavinia's husband, Sarah married Moses McWilliams when she was only 14 years old. At 18, she gave birth to a daughter named Lelia, and at 20, she was widowed. Sarah then decided to move to St. Louis, where she worked as a laundress and in other domestic positions for 18 years. She joined St. Paul's African Methodist Episcopal Church and put her daughters through public school and Knoxville College. Sarah, who was barely literate, was especially proud of her daughter's education accomplishments. Let me back up. This same woman who was the first black woman millionaire was illiterate. Okay? By the time she was in her late 30s, Sarah was contending with hair loss because of a combination of stress and damaging hair care products. After experimenting with various methods, she developed a formula of her own that caused her hair to grow again quickly. She often recounted that after praying about her hair, she was given the formula in a dream. Let me repeat that. She often recounted that after praying about her hair, she was given the formula in a dream. When friends and family members noticed how Sarah's hair grew back, they began to ask her to duplicate her products to them. She began to prepare her formula at home, selling it to friends and family, and marketing it door to door. I'm going to stop right there because a lot of people, when they hear of Madam C.J. Walker, they always say, well, she's the woman that invented the relaxer and, you know, we should wear our hair natural and, you know, we can't talk, you know, she's not a good example because she invented a relaxer. to anybody who wants to say that type of BS, they never bothered to research Madam C.J. Walker on her own. She did not invent a straightening comb, and she did not invent a relaxer or a quote-unquote perm. She invented a product that helped to grow hair back and condition the scalp. That's what she invented. With help of her family and her second husband, Charles Joseph Walker, a newspaper man whom she married in 1906 after she moved to Denver, she began to advertise a growing number of hair care products. She adopted her husband's initials and surname as her professional name, calling herself Madam C.J. Walker for the rest of her life, even after her marriage ended. Her husband helped her develop mail marketing techniques for her products, usually through the medium of African-American-owned newspapers. When their small business was successful with earnings of about $10 a day, again, this was in the mid to late 1800s, Walker felt that she could continue to expand, but her husband felt that she was too ambitious. Rather than allowing her husband's wishes to restrain her, the couple separated. Walker's business continued to develop as she not only marketed her hair care products but also tutored African-American men and women in their use, recruiting a group called Walker Agents. Her products often used in conjunction with a metal comb that was heated on stove and used to straighten very curly hair. She also began to manufacture a facial cream. The hair process was controversial because many felt that African-American women should wear their hair in natural styles rather than attempt to change the texture from curly to straight. In spite of critics, Walker's hair care methods gained increasing popularity among African-American women who enjoyed products designed especially for them. This resulted in growing profits for Walker's business and an increasing number of agents who marketed the products for her door-to-door. Working closely with her daughter, Lelia, Walker opened a school for hair culturists in Pittsburgh, Lelia College, which operated from 1908 to 1910. So I want to pause here. This is also the first black woman to open a beauty school in 1910. The Walkers moved to Indianapolis where they established a modern factory to produce their products. So she was also the first black woman to manufacture her own products and build a manufacturing plant to produce the products. They also began to hire African-American professionals who could direct various aspects of the operation. Among the workers were tutors who helped Walker get a basic education. Walker traveled through the nation demonstrating her products, recruiting salespersons, practitioners, and encouraging African-American entrepreneurs. Her rounds included conventions of African-American organizations, churches, and civic groups. Not content with her domestic achievements, Walker traveled to the Caribbean and Latin America to promote her business and to recruit individuals to teach hair care methods. Observers estimated the Walker Company had about 3,000 agents from whom Walker had held annual conventions where they were tutored in product use, hygienic care techniques, and marketing strategies. She also gave cash rewards to those who were most successful in promoting sales. Okay? Now, and there's something else that people don't talk about Madam C.J. Walker. This woman was the first black woman to do so many things just off of something she prayed on and received in a dream. Talk about a black woman's intuition. Okay, but she was also a first in another very, very, very important thing. In December of 1916, just after her 49th birthday, the woman known as Madam C.J. Walker made an announcement so shocking it caused certain people to gasp in astonishment and exclaim, "Impossible!" At least that's how the New York Times Magazine described their response. Walker had, she proclaimed, just purchased a 4.25-acre estate in Irvington on Hudson in New York, and she was planning to erect on it a home that will cost me no less than $100,000, and it's going to be very swell. Indeed, and so what? So for one thing, Irving at the time was pretty much infested with robber barons and Gilded Age millionaires, making it one of the most swankiest addresses in the country. So for another, it was an adorable little village located an easy 19 miles from Manhattan, near the Messers, Carnegies, Rockefellers, Tiffany, Biddle, you know, et cetera. To rush out after work, play golf, and get ice cream, blah, blah, blah. Now, this is the very important thing. Madam C.J.'s Walker property was located in a choice spot with an exclusive Winchester County community overlooking the Hudson River from a high point on Broadway near a Presbyterian church maybe a half a mile from Sunnyside Washington Irving's home. So the package was very swell, as she said. Now, the thing that gets it here is she bought property and built a home custom-made in a section where they had they have outlawed Irish Jews and Irish and Jews from buying property there. But this is the kicker. They thought it was impossible for a black woman, a black person, not a black woman, but any black person to be able to afford property there. So they didn't bother outlawing black people. So when she made this announcement that she bought that property, they were like, how is that possible? But then they look back at the books and realize they never even thought a black person was able to do that. So she did it right in their face, and there was nothing they could do. And she had pretty much, you know, a very, very good home in that neighborhood. So, and that home is still standing today, and it's a historic monument. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Again, Madam C.J. Walker.
Okay. The next.
Oh, wait. I'm sorry. There was a quote that she gave that I really, because I want to read this quote. The quote was, I am a woman who came from the cotton fields of the South. From there, I was promoted to the washtub. From there, I was promoted to the cook kitchen. And from there, I promoted myself into the business of manufacturing hair goods and preparations. I have built my own factory on my own ground, Madam C.J. Walker.
That's right. Okay. The sister I'm going to talk about right now is
Mrs. Charlotta Bass.
Oh.
Charlotta Amanda Spears Bass was born in 1874, and she died on April 12, 1969.
She was an American educator, newspaper publisher, editor, and civil rights activist. Bass was probably the first African-American woman to own and operate her own newspaper in the United States. She published the California Eagle from 1912 until 1951. In 1952, Bass became the first African-American woman nominated to run for national office as the Progressive Party's vice presidential candidate. Again, in 1952, Bass became the first African-American woman nominated to run for national office as the Progressive Party's vice presidential candidate. Okay.
Born Charlotta Spears in Sumter, South Carolina, the sixth of 11 children, born to Hiram Spears, a brick mason, and his wife, Kate, a housewife. She moved to Rhode Island after high school and began working in the newspaper business. She then moved to Los Angeles, California in 1910. Soon after arriving in the city, she took a job selling subscriptions to the small African-American newspaper, the California Owl. Just before the owner, John J. Nemore, died, he asked Bass to take over the paper. Changing the name to the California Eagle, Bass in 1913 hired Joseph Blackburn Bass, who eventually became the editor of the paper as well as her husband. She hired her husband. Anywho.
That's right.
That's right. Okay. After J.B. Bass's death in 1934, Charlotta Bass continued and expanded the newspaper's political advocacy, highlighting many of her issues and causes. By 1925, the California Eagle employed a staff of 12 and published 20 pages a week. The Eagle circulation of 60,000 made it the largest African-American newspaper on the West Coast. As editor and publisher of the California Eagle, then the oldest black newspaper on the West Coast, she had fought against restricted covenants in housing and segregated schools in L.A. She had also taken part in successful campaigns to end job discriminations at the Los Angeles General Hospital, the Los Angeles Rapid Transit Company, the Southern Telephone Company, and the Boulder Dam Project.
Bass was also the co-president of the Los Angeles division of the Marcus Garvey Universal Negro Improvement Association.
Repeat that.
Again, Bass was co-president of the Los Angeles division of the Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association.
Okay, I'm sorry. What was her name again?
Charlotta Bass.
I've never heard of her before.
One more time. Bass was the co-president of the Los Angeles division of the Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association during the early 1920s and was the West Coast promoter of the Don't Buy Where You Can't Work campaigns of the mid to late 1930s. In 1943, Bass led a group of black leaders on a visit to Mayor Fletcher Bowen's office. They demanded an expansion of the Mayor's Committee on American Unity, more public mass meetings to promote interracial unity, and an end to the discriminatory hiring practices of the privately owned Los Angeles Railway Company. The mayor listened but agreed to do no more than to expand his committee. She was the director of the youth movement of the NAACP. The youth NAACP had 200 members, including some actors and actresses such as Lena Horne, Hattie McDaniel, and Louise Beavers. She also served in 1952 as the national chairman of the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, an organization of black women set up to protest racial violence in the South. Let me skip one part. Let me get right here. Bass's uncompromising stance against racial injustice resulted in her life being threatened on numerous occasions. She was branded a communist, and the FBI placed her under surveillance on the charge that her paper was seditious. However, this never deterred her or her paper from seeking civil and political rights for African Americans and the disadvantaged. Okay, after years as a registered Republican, she left the party in 1948. In the Progressive Party presidential campaign of 1952, she was the running mate of lawyer Vincent Hallinan. She wrote her last column for the California Eagle on April 26, 1951, and sold the paper soon after. Considering the sum of her career as she was completing 40 years, Charlotta wrote, "It has been a good life that I have had, though a very hard one, but I know the future will be even better. And as I think back, I know that is the only kind of life, and serving one's fellow man, one serves himself best." Charlotta Bass died April 12, 1969, in Los Angeles, California.
Wow. Now, go ahead.
No, I was just laughing. You had to take a moment and absorb all of that.
Yeah. These women are amazing. I mean, they're amazing. I'm glad that we are doing this series of shows, and it's a lot of briefly. It's a lot of women or a lot of people on the switchboard with their hands up. We will get to the callers toward the end of the show because there are so many sisters that we want to speak their names that I don't want to get too much into conversation for right now. We'll save that for the end because we got about 52 minutes and we're not even halfway through the system that we're not present to everybody today. So write down your comments or questions and save them for the end, but we definitely will get to you and don't hang up because, we'll get there. Woo! Okay. The next sister that I am going to talk about is a sister that some of us have heard about before, Drusilla Dungy Houston, 1876 through 1941. It is rare in the field of African historical research and writing that African women are prominently mentioned. The work of Drusilla Dungy Houston is not only worth mentioning, but should be highlighted as an early pioneering historical narrative displaying scholarly depth and superb documentation. Drusilla Dungy Houston is the author of Wonderful Ethiopians of the Ancient Kushite Empire. She's an educator and journalist. Drusilla Dungy Houston, born June 20th, 1876, in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, was the daughter of Reverend John William Dungy and Lydia Ann Taylor Dungy. She had 9 siblings. The Dungy family came to Oklahoma in 1892. Although from a wealthy family, Drusilla Dungy never attended college. However, she attended finishing schools in the North. Despite plans to be a concert pianist, she gave up the stage to teach. In 1892 through 99, she was employed as a kindergarten teacher in Oklahoma City and was one of the first elementary school teachers in the district. Houston devoted her early years to education. Dissatisfied with the public education offerings for black girls and women, she started her own school. In 1898, at 22, Houston eloped and married Price Houston. The couple settled in McAllister in Indian Territory, where Drusilla soon opened McAllister Seminary for Girls, where she operated for 12 years. In 1917, she went to Sepulpa, Oklahoma, as principal of the Oklahoma Baptist College for Girls, where she remained until 1923. On her return to Oklahoma City, she started the Oklahoma Vocational Institute of Fine Arts and Crafts. After 1934, she served as a religious director of the Oklahoma Home for Delinquent Boys. Houston's historical significance lies in her contributions to the historical writings and journalism. The earliest African-American woman to write a multi-volume study of, actually, she wasn't the earliest, let me make this clear, she was the first black woman to write a multi-volume study of ancient Africa. She is best known for her classic American historical text, Wonderful Ethiopians of the Ancient Kushite Empire. Now, it is very important that the sisters read this book because it has some very poignant information about the societies in ancient Kush. That book is in the temple in the goddess libraries for those sisters who are part of the temple that would like to read that book. Written over a 25-year period, the book was published in 1926 and reprinted in 1986. Wonderful Ethiopians was written to correct distortions in the historical record of ancient African people and their descendants worldwide. In a sense, she anticipated the Negritude movement, early Pan-Africanism and Black Studies and African-American Studies movement. While conducting her historical research, Houston also wrote lengthy editorials on a wide range of subjects for her brother Roscoe's newspaper, The Black Dispatch, a crusading voice for civil rights. Her journalistic career began in 1917 with editorials written for the Booker T. Searchlight, an earlier paper owned by Roscoe. Much later, she wrote for the Arizona Journal and Guide after she moved to Arizona for health reasons in 1935. Houston received national recognition for her editorial work after 1925 as a syndicated writer with the Associated Negro Press. A few years after syndication of her articles, A&P Director Claude Barnett appointed her as a director of research, a position she maintained until 1939 when she became too ill to write. Throughout most of her years of journalism and church work, Houston also stayed involved in the social activities of that time. For instance, she was a founder of the Oklahoma YWCA, the Red Cross, and the NAACP. She was also a longtime active member of the Federated Colored Women's Club and worked hard to support African-American youth programs. She assisted in founding the Dogan Reading Room of Oklahoma and served as the group's president. The Association of Black Women Historians and Black Classic Press honored her accomplishments by cooperatively establishing the Drusilla Dungy Houston Memorial Scholarship Fund. Although known primarily for her work as a historian, Houston was a writer of poems, many of which survive, and as stated, she was also an activist and a journalist. And most of her writings was depicting horrors of lynching. Houston had 2 children, Florence and another unnamed daughter who earlier died. Price Houston died in 1931. Like her mother, Drusilla suffered for years from tuberculosis. Drusilla Dungy Houston died in Phoenix, Arizona on February 8, 1941. All right. Drusilla Dungy Houston.
That's right. Okay. The great black woman I'm going to speak on now is Sister Septima Poinsett Clark. Yeah, Septima.
I had never heard of her before you told me about her.
She was actually
you know how they refer to Rosa Parks as the mother of the civil rights movement?
Yep.
Miss Septima
yep.
is actually the godmother, and she had been actively campaigning for, actively just working towards improvement for black people throughout the country, but, you know, racial equality, things like that, a decade before the civil rights movement even became known, really. Okay, one thing that I did want to read, actually from the information, Sister Seek actually downloaded, that is a great quote. And what it says is, it is good to remember, especially when faced with life's challenges, that we stand on the shoulders of many great women who have gone before us and whose legacy gives us strength. And with that, let me read about Septima. Septima Clark was called the mother of the civil rights movement. Since she used education as a tool to liberate and empower black people to fight against segregation and racial discrimination. But even before she began working for civil rights, Septima Clark had helped organize equal rights for black teachers in the 1920s. As a teaching principal at a school in Charleston, South Carolina, Clark made $35 a week while the other teacher made $25. Meanwhile, the white school across the street had only 3 students, and the teacher who worked there received $85 a week. It was her firsthand experience with these inequalities that led Clark to become an active proponent for pay equalization for teachers. It was in 1919 that her pay equalization work brought her into the movement for civil rights. Septima Clark's courage, faith, patience, skill, and intellectual and moral character was a driving force behind the civil rights movement and was fundamental to black people's literacy and access to political life in the United States. She is one of the marginalized sheroes of the civil rights movement, even though she trained and inspired a majority of movement leaders, including Rosa Parks.
Yep.
Let me skip to something really briefly, what Rosa had actually said about her. Okay, Rosa Parks, who has been called the mother of the civil rights movement, well remembers the first time she met Septima Clark. It was at a civil rights workshop in Tennessee in the summer of 1955. African Americans and sympathetic whites had begun to meet quietly, secretly throughout the South to plan their counterattacks against the segregation system and to train the new core of volunteers for that fight. These volunteers would come to be called civil rights workers. Septima Clark, already a 30-year veteran of her people's struggle, was one of the trainers.
Mm.
Okay, we're talking again. We're talking about Tennessee in the summer of 1955. Septima Clark, already a 30-year veteran of her people's struggle, was one of the trainers. At that time, I was nervous, very troubled in my mind about the events that were occurring in Montgomery, Rosa Parks says. But then I had a chance to work with Septima. She was such a calm and dedicated person in the midst of all that danger. I thought, if I could only catch some of her spirit, I wanted to have the courage to accomplish the kind of things that she had been doing for decades. After the sessions with Clark, Parks returned to Montgomery, Alabama, saying she had a firmness and self-confidence she had not felt before. 3 months later, she refused to give up her seat on a bus so that a white person could sit down, the act which marks the beginning of the modern civil rights movement. I'm going to read a couple more things, and I'm going to skip back to the original thing I was reading. Septima Clark was a single mother, public school teacher, quietly devout Christian. She began organizing anti-racist activities in the Deep South in the 1920s. Again, she began organizing anti-racist activities in the Deep South in the 1920s. She stuck through the movement in its most difficult moments, dark nights of fear on lonely back highways, the bombing and burning of churches and meeting halls, the beatings and murders of friends and coworkers. She volunteered to work in the most dangerous spot, surviving jail and 2 heart attacks in the process.
Wow.
She lived to witness the movement's greatest triumphs. The end of segregated public facilities, the passage of the Great Civil Rights Legislation of the 1960s, the election of African-American public officials in the South first time in 100 years.
Since the end of the Civil War, the states of the old Confederacy had sunk in their teeth and sucked the life of the former slaves while the nation turned its back and looked the other way. And when these African-American citizens got tired of their condition and said they had enough, the violence broke upon them like sheets of summer rain. They lost their jobs. They were beaten. They were jailed. Their houses were firebombed. They were dragged from their homes in the silent screaming of the night by ghostly men in flowing robes and hung from trees and burned. Their body parts sliced off and passed around to be put on mantelpieces and pickle jars as souvenirs. Violence and the threat of violence had kept the Black South in check for 100 years. But by the end of the 1950s, in shantytown villages and cross-the-tracking communities throughout the South, intimidation was no longer working. It goes on to say, Septima, the lifelong teacher, figured she set up a few schools to show her people how to take advantage of this new freedom and the new rights that were being opened up to them. She says, I just created a little chaos. Chaos is a good thing. God created the whole world out of chaos. Change is what comes from it.
God sure did. She did create the whole world out of chaos.
That's right. Septima Clark was an activist, educator, and a feminist. Born in Charleston, South Carolina in 1898, her father was a former slave, and her mother, although born in Charleston, was raised in Haiti. Septima Clark became a teacher in South Carolina public schools at the age of 18. After 40 years of teaching, she was fired because she refused to give up her membership in the NAACP. She was 58 years old at the time, but instead of considering retirement, Septima Clark went to work as director of workshops at the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee. Highlander was founded by Miles Horton in 1932 as essentially a training ground for people, Black and white, desiring change in their communities. Only 3 months after attending one of Septima Clark's workshops at Highlander in 1955, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus. One of Septima Clark's many contributions to the civil rights movement included the citizenship school she set up all over the South, first through Highlander and then through the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, to teach Blacks to read and write so they could pass literacy tests to be eligible to register to vote. Thousands of Black people registered to vote because of Septima Clark's work, either directly with them or through one of the local people she had trained as a teacher. Many adult Blacks were unable to read or sign their own names because they never attended school, or the schools they attended were inferior. Septima Clark helped to change all of that by traveling tirelessly all over the South to train local people to become citizenship teachers so they could go back into their communities and to teach others. Citizenship schools taught Blacks basic literacy, including how to write their names, balance their checkbooks, and read road signs. The schools also taught democratic principles, including the United States Constitution, the way the government works, and how to vote in elections. Through her citizenship school, Septima Clark revolutionized politics in the South. She often faced grave danger traveling through parts of the Deep South where civil rights activists were beaten and lynched. She often received death threats, and many of her friends were killed. Through her willingness to confront class divisions within the civil rights movement, Septima Clark made sure that Black leaders understood the need to respect Black local people in the South who were the backbone of the movement. An example of this is when Andrew Young, Septima Clark's boss at the Leaders Conference, chartered a plane to fly in for the opening ceremonies of a new flock of recruits for citizenship training. Septima Clark stopped him on his way to get something to eat and told him he should eat with the recruits who had just arrived by bus. When Young told her that there was no money in the budget to pay for food for the recruits, she retorted that if he could use the foundation money they had gotten to run the program to rent a plane, then he could surely find $2 or $3 to buy breakfast for those who had spent all night traveling on a bus to get there. If he recruits, then he too should remain hungry, she said. In the face of her blunt reasoning, Young ended up eating brown bag lunches with the new recruits. Did you hear that? Septima Clark.
Repeat that again.
Okay. An example of this is when Andrew Young, Septima Clark's boss at the SCLC, chartered a plane to fly the opening ceremonies of a new flock of recruits for citizenship training. Septima Clark stopped him on his way to get something to eat and told him he should eat with the recruits who had just arrived by bus. When Young told her that there was no money in the budget to pay for food for the recruits, she
that if he could use the foundation money they had gotten to run the program to rent a plane, then he could surely find $2 or $3 to buy breakfast for those who had spent all night traveling on bus to get there. If he couldn't feed the recruits, then he too should remain hungry, she said. In the face of her blunt reasoning, Young ended up eating brown bag lunches with the new recruits. As a feminist, Septima Clark worked on behalf of women starting as early as 1955. It was that year, before the Montgomery bus boycott, that she spoke to black women at several churches in Montgomery and got some of them to go to Highlander for training. In 1958, she traveled to D.C. to speak to women at the National Organization for Women about life for black and white women in the South, and she returned a few years later to talk about black women's experiences with voter registration. This remarkable woman accomplished a lot in her lifetime. Although her principal and teachers recommended that she go to college when she was 18, her parents did not have the means to send her. However, she was determined to get a college education. In 1930, at the age of 32, Septima Clark began taking summer classes at Columbia University in New York City. Let me read that again. In 1930, at the age of 32, Septima Clark began taking summer classes at Columbia University in New York City. She began these classes primarily because she felt she was not getting the results she expected from the children she was teaching in South Carolina. 7 years later, she continued to Atlanta University in Georgia, where she took more courses, including one taught by W.E.B. Du Bois. She persevered in her pursuit of her bachelor's degree, and finally in 1942, she was awarded her degree from Benedict College. She did not stop there, however, and 3 years later, she went on to receive a master's degree from Hampton at the age of 47. Whew. Now, the last thing I'm going to say, during her career in service organization, she also worked with the Tuberculosis Association and the Charleston Health Department. She was also an active member of the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. Clark retired from active work with the SCLC in 1970. She later sought reinstatement of the pension and back salary that had been canceled when she was dismissed as a teacher in 1956, which she had successfully won. Again, she later sought reinstatement of the pension and back salary that had been canceled when she was dismissed as a teacher in 1956, which she successfully won. She was later to serve 2 terms on the Charleston County School Board. U.S. President Jimmy Carter awarded Clark a Living Legacy Award in 1979. In 1987, her second autobiography, Ready from Within, Septima Clark and the Civil Rights Movement, won the American Book Award. Septima Clark died December 15, 1987. In a eulogy presented at her funeral, president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference described the importance of Clark's work in her relationship to the SCLC. Reverend Joseph Lowry asserted that her courageous and pioneering efforts in the area of citizenship education and interracial cooperation won her the SCLC's highest award, the Drum Major for Justice Award. She is buried at Old Bethel United Methodist Church Cemetery in Charleston, South Carolina.
Septima Poinsett Clark.
Oh, I skipped one thing. Clark would struggle against sexism during her time on the SCLC, as had Ella Baker, with the bulk of sexism emanating from Martin Luther King Jr. I skipped that. Sorry. I had to throw that in.
Whew. Let me get myself
ready.
Septima
Clark. Powerful
lady.
Well,
you know, the thing that is upsetting to me about Septima Clark, and it's not upsetting to me about her, what's upsetting to me is that she is the godmother of the civil rights movement. She was a mover and shaker well before we have even heard of MLKs and Malcolm X's and Marcus Garvey's.
And see, another thing is, I want to say this, and I've said this to you numerous times. It's, Okay, and this is not to minimize anybody else's accomplishment. I am not trying to minimize anybody's accomplishment. However, it's just funny that certain people's history is taught to us, but we don't know anything about these ladies. But if we talk
right.
about if we talk about it in simple terms as far as success, being successful at what they do, I mean, my biggest thing was like, okay, I'll use an example. Harriet Tubman. We know about Harriet Tubman, of course we do. But she's kind of minimized when
yep.
you get into mixed groups and they talk about Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey and all of them. It's like, you know, I give the brothers respect to have the courage to get up there and fight by any means necessary. I that's great. I am not trying to knock that. You know, I'm not trying to knock what they did. However, when we look at terms of success, no one was freed when Nat Turner led his revolt. Everybody was killed. Matter of fact, when they killed Nat Turner, they skinned him and made purses and lampshades out of his skin. Nobody knows what happened to Denmark Vesey. They know they killed him and the other people with him. So when we talk about success, Harriet Tubman actually freed people. They lived to see their freedom.
She did.
Harriet lived to see her freedom.
Yes, she did.
Nat Turner didn't. Denmark Vesey didn't. So anyway, we need to stop minimizing women's role regardless. You know, it's ridiculous that we just talk about it in goddess circles. Everybody should know this. Like, one of my next things is, while I'm teaching my son knowledge of self, I'm not just going to teach him about Nat Turner. I'm going to make sure that he knows about, you know, my lady, Dr. Vivian Penn, and he knows about Charlotta Bass and all this other stuff.
Right.
He needs to know about the women, too. We are strong.
Right.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm done. Go ahead.
Oh, no, no. What you said needed to be said, you know. It's, and then the thing is the name calling. We are not in middle school and elementary school. Does it really matter what somebody else thinks about you when it comes to you having a clear and concise understanding of who and what you are as a black woman?
Exactly. And the last thing I want to say, and I can actually say that I'm guilty as far as the name calling or whatever, but it's really funny that even looking at sisters, like when we get into some of the sisters who are part of the Black Liberation
Girl.
Movement, but like the first thing they do to discredit the sisters is label them a feminist. Like, when did feminism?
Or you're gay, or you're a lesbian.
My question is this: when did being for women? When is that a bad thing? Like, you know,
right,
how come you're
a woman?
How come you're trying to entice me to fight for, quote, our liberation as black people, but it's not, but I'm looked down or made fun of if I'm fighting for my liberation as a woman? I'm not, you know, I don't know. Anyway, Claudia Jones.
How come every time we do something, we can fight for liberation of black people, but you can't fight for women's rights, or you can't fight for, I mean, it absolutely makes no sense. Essentially, what is being said, if you read in between the lines, if you look at the idiom there, if you read in between the line, that means we want black people to be free, quote unquote. And it's very possible that, you know what, I'm gonna say, you know what, no, fuck it, I'm not going to say that comment. Essentially, what's being taught, if you look at it and you read in between the lines, is that black women don't need liberation, just a black man. And if that's that true, how come our energy and our resources are always used as the backbone of all of these movements, but we can't stand up and say we're not going to allow y'all to treat us like this?
And I'm going to kick it a little different. It's almost like they're selling you this. They're selling you this way. Like, once we fight for our freedom, so they got you all hyped up for freedom. And don't get me wrong, that is the goal. We should all be fighting for freedom. But it'll be like, once we fight for freedom, then you must immediately return to the kitchen or the mattress and don't say nothing and don't ask me no questions or anything of that nature. And if I want two or three of y'all to live in the house, that's what we're going to do. So in essence, it's like black women.
Right now.
But wait. But in essence, it's almost like, okay, what you're trying to sell to me is I'm going to fight for, quote, freedom. However, I'm basically exchanging bondage from one system to bondage in another. Like, wait a minute. And just like, and the last thing I'm going to end up is Claudia Jones. We're going to touch on her on another series. She was a black woman writer, feminist, back in the day. But one of the things that I like that she said, she was like, you know, the men kind of kick it to you in a certain kind of way that's, you know, just like I said, one is for another, or we're not equal, or whatever they like to say, like black women, black men are not equal. But she was like, I'm not necessarily fighting for equality. I'm fighting for the right to be different, to be black,
right,
and to be me. That's what,
right,
I'm fighting for. I'm
right.
fighting for the ability just to be different and be me. Anyway, okay.
All right, let's see. Atta B. Wales Barnett. Atta B. Wales Barnett. A lot of us have heard of her before, but do we really know what her contribution was and some of the things that she did? So we're going to get into this, and I found some interesting things about her. 1862 to 1931. Born of slaves, Atta B. Wales Barnett fought to stop the lynching of black Americans, carrying her fight to the White House. In 1898, she was part of a delegation to President McKinley demanding government action in the case of black postmaster who had been lynched in South Carolina. Wales Barnett's parents, freed from slavery shortly after her birth, died of malaria when she was 14. To support her brother and sister, she became a school teacher. I'm going to get back to that part in a minute. I do want to say that she was one of the founders of the NAACP and was active in the Negro Women's Club movement. She opposed Booker T. Washington's philosophy of accommodation. She, along with other black women, marched in suffragist parades, and she worked with Jane Addams to block the segregations of schools in Chicago. Now I have to skip to another section because we've had to use a whole lot of different resources to get this information. Let's see. Atta B. Wales was a newspaper editor and journalist who went on to lead the American anti-lynching crusades, working closely with both African-American community leaders and American suffragists. Note to self. Wales worked to raise gender issues with the race question and race issues with the woman question. Wales was born the daughter of slaves in Holly Springs, Mississippi, on July 16, 1862. During Reconstruction, she was educated at a Missouri Freedmen's School, Rust University, and began teaching at the age of 14. In 1884, she moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where she continued to teach while attending Fisk University during summer sessions. In Tennessee, especially, she bristled at the poor treatment she and other African Americans received. After she was forcibly removed from her seat for refusing to move to a colored car, I'm gonna skip to something else right quick because they don't really get into all of it, so. On May 4, 1884, a Chesapeake, Ohio Railroad Company train conductor ordered Wales to give up her seat on the train and move to a smoking car, which was already crowded with other passengers. At the time, the Supreme Court had just struck down the civil rights cases in 1883. The Federal Civil Rights Act of 1875, which banned racial discrimination in public accommodations, several railroad companies were able to continue legal racial segregation of their passengers. Wales protested and refused to give up her seat 71 years before Rosa Parks. The conductor and two other men dragged Wales out of the car. When she returned to Memphis, she immediately hired an African-American attorney to sue the railroad. Wales became a public figure in Memphis when she wrote a newspaper article, quote, The Living Way, a black church weekly about her treatment on the train. When her lawyer, who was a black man, was paid off by the railroad, I'm sorry, that just blew me. But anyway, her lawyer was paid off by the railroad. She hired a white attorney. She won her case on December 24, 1884, when the local circuit court granted her a $500 settlement. The railroad company appealed to the Tennessee Supreme Court, which reversed the lower court's ruling in 1885, concluding that, we think it is evident that the purpose of the defendant in error was to harass with a view to this suit and that her persistence was not in a good faith to obtain a comfortable seat for the short ride, unquote. Wells was ordered to pay court costs. All right, let me get back to this other section I was reading. In 1892, Wells wrote a scathing series of editorials following the lynching of three prominent African-American Memphis businessmen, friends of Wells. In the aftermath of the lynchings and her outspoken criticism of it, her newspaper office was sacked. Wells then moved to New York City, where she continued to write editorials and exposés against lynchings, which was at an epidemic level in the years after Reconstruction. I'm going to skip to another part because there's some very interesting information about what she found in her researching lynchings. Okay. In 1892, she published a pamphlet titled Southern Horrors, Lynch Laws in All Its Phases and a Red Record, 1892 to 1894, which documented research on the lynching. Having examined many accounts of lynchings based on alleged rape of white women, she concluded that Southerners concocted rape as an excuse to hide their real reason for lynching. Black economic progress, which threatened not only white Southerners' pocketbooks, but also their ideas about black inferiority. This lesson teaches, and which every Afro-American should ponder well, is that a Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every black home, and it should be used for that protection which the law refuses to give. When the white man, who is always the aggressor, knows he runs a risk of biting the dust every time his Afro-American victim does, he will have great respect for African-American life. For the African-American yields and cringes and begs, the more he has to do so, the more he is insulted, outraged, and lynched. Okay, I'm going to get further into what she came up with in her lynchings here, so please, sisters, pay close attention. The Red Record was a 100-page pamphlet describing lynchings in the U.S. since Emancipation Proclamation, while also describing black struggles since the time of Emancipation Proclamation. The Red Record begins by explaining the alarming severity of lynching situations in the U.S. An ignorance of lynching in the U.S., according to Ada, developed over a span of 10 years. Ada talks about slavery, saying the black man's body and soul were owned by the white man. The soul was dwarfed by the white man, and the body was preserved because of his value. Ada mentions that 10,000 Negroes have been killed in cold blood without the formality of judicial trial and legal execution. Therefore, launching her campaign against lynching in this pamphlet, The Red Record. Frederick Douglass wrote an article explaining the three eras of Southern barbarism and excuses that coincided with each. Ada goes into details about each excuse. The first excuse that Ada explains is the necessity of white man to repress and stamp out allegedly race riots. Once the Civil War ended, there were many riots supposedly being planned by blacks. Whites panicked and resisted them forcefully. The second excuse came during the Reconstruction era. Blacks were lynched because whites feared Negro domination and wanted to stay powerful in the government. Wells encouraged those threatened to move their families somewhere safe. The third excuse was blacks had, quote, to be killed to avenge their assault upon women, unquote. Ada explains that any relationship between a white woman and a black man was considered rape during that time period. In these articles, she states, nobody in this section of the country believes the old threadbare lie that Negro men rape white women. Ada lists 14 pages of statistics concerning lynchings done from 1892 to 1895. She also included pages of graphic stories detailing lynchings done in the South. Ada credits her findings to the white correspondents, white press bureaus, and white newspapers. Now, the reason I think this is interesting is because she used their documentation to prove her case. Through her life, Wells was militant in her demand for equality and justice for African Americans and insisted that the African American community win justice through its own efforts. Since her death, interest of her life and legacy has grown. A woman born in slavery, she would grow to become one of the great pioneers activists of the civil rights movement, a precursor of Rosa Parks. She was a suffragist, newspaper editor, publisher, investigator journalist, co-founder of the NAACP, political candidate, mother, wife, and single most powerful leader in the anti-lynching campaign in America. A dynamic, controversial, temperamental, uncompromising race woman. She broke bread and crossed swords with some of the movers and shakers of her time. Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, Marcus Garvey, Booker T. Washington, W.E. Du Bois, Francis Willard, President McKinley. By any fair assessment, she was a seminal figure in post-Reconstruction America. Now, I'm going to highlight something about her that I know I researched it, but I can't find the exact quote in here. But the thing that I found that was interesting is that when she was researching the lynchings, it was found that they considered, and I stated this a couple minutes ago, they considered a relationship between a black man and a white woman rape. And so they found that every time, in most cases when black men were hung, it was because of relationships that were actually consensual with white women. During this time period, we have a lot of single black women taking care of children. That's all I'm going to say. there's a lot more on Ida B. Wells. I mean, a lot more. I suggest that people look her up because there's a lot more that she did. But the funny thing is, we know a lot about W.E. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass. I mean, Frederick Douglass was hounded in me in second and third grade, but I was never taught about Ida B. Wells. So, yeah. All right.
Okay. The woman that I'm going to speak on now is Marie Therese. It's spelled coin, but according to this article, the
proper way to pronounce it is Coquay, and
it'll get into the reason later. So Marie Therese Coin. She was born in August of 1742, and she died in 1816. She was most notable as a free woman, planter and businesswoman in a Louisiana parish. She was freed from slavery after a long liaison and 10 children with Claude Thomas Pierre Metoyer. She and her descendants established a community of fields of color at Isle Breville, including what is believed to be the first church founded by free people of color for free people of color, St. Augustine Parish Church in Natchez, Louisiana. It is included on the Louisiana African American Heritage Trail. Coquay was born at the Louisiana French outpost of, in Louisiana, the fourth of 11 children of Francois and Marie Francois. Both were African captives enslaved by the post founder and commandant, Louis Joshua. The couple were married in the parish church just 3 weeks after Francois' baptism in 1735, suggesting that their marriage, like their religious conversion, was dictated by their master. The lives of Coquay's birth family, based on archival research and family tradition, is told by Coquay's principal biographer in the historical novel Isle of Can. As children, Coquay and her sister Marie-Louise Mariette were trained in pharmacology and nursing. These skills helped provide livelihoods when they gained their freedom as adults. Their other 9 siblings would remain enslaved at various colonial outposts. Coquay became the young mother of 5 children born of a union with an American Indian slave, according to tradition. About 1765, her mistress leased Coquay to a young French merchant, Claude Thomas Pierre Metoyer, who made Coquay his concubine. After Metoyer freed her in 1778, their liaison continued until 1788, when he married another woman named Marie Therese, a white French Creole widow. Metoyer gave Coquay a tract of 68 acres of alluvial river bottom land and gradually manumitted the surviving 8 of the 10 children she had born to him. I just wanted to start real quick. Now, again, a lot of, you know, she was the mistress of this white French merchant or whatever, and, you know, she continued her liaison with him after 10 years when he married a white woman. However, even, you know, regardless of what stigma is attached to that, when their liaison was over, homegirl got a tract of 68 acres. So I don't mean to put it in vulgar terms, but if you're going to give the cat out, you might as well get 68 acres worth of land in return.
That's right.
You know what
I'm saying? Right now, nobody should be giving any kutch away from free. And yes, I said kutch.
again. So, yeah, she had 10 children by a dude, and he, you know, went to go marry a white woman. All right. However, a part of their settlement, he gave her 68 acres. If you don't know how big 68 acres is, go look it up. Okay. As a free woman, Coakley earned her living as a, now they say, it says medicine, like a French medicine word, but basically as a nurse, like nursing slash doctor, or like Sister C, natural holistic practitioner, let's put it that way. Again, she was trained in nursing and pharmacy when she was young. A planter of tobacco and a trapper. She sold meat at the post. She also shipped barrels of oil and barge loads of tobacco to market at New Orleans.
In 1794, she applied for a Spanish grant and was awarded the standard 800 arpents, about 666 acres of land.
She located her grant in the Piney Hills west of the Con River for use as a vacherie and hired a Spaniard to operate it for her. Like many other freed slaves in colonial Louisiana, Coakley bought slaves to labor for her as her own health began to fail. By the time she divided her property among her children in 1816 in anticipation of death, the three African-born adults whom she had purchased had created a household of 16 slaves. Coakley has been a long popular figure in Louisiana lore. She is frequently said to have owned large estates, including the Con River's fabled Melrose Plantation. In fact, this land was granted to and built on by one of her sons, Louis. Coakley lived a life of frugality and service to others, investing all her income into the purchase of freedom for her pre-employer children, grandchildren, and other youth in the neighborhood. The example which she set and the religious and moral values which she instilled in her offspring were the guiding forces of an exceptional community built by her children and grandchildren on the river. Her eldest son, Augustine, donated the land for a church, St. Augustine Parish Church, and commissioned his brother Louis to build it in 1829. It is believed to be America's first church founded by free people of color. Tradition holds that Coakley's African-born parents retain their culture, and some evidence supports that. No known documents identify the African birthplace of either parent. Coakley and four of her siblings carried African names. One African linguist proposed in the 1970s that the African coin, spelled variously by French and Spanish scribes but pronounced Coakley, was the name used by second-born daughters among those who speak the Glizzy dialect among the Iowa of coastal Togo. Historian Mills and Mills found evidence that Coakley was the second-born daughter in her birth family. Other possible origins of the name Coin, together with the sibling names uncovered by the Millses, are being pursued by the African scholar Kevin MacDonald at the Institute of Archaeology, University College in London.
It's not actually in my notes, but the one thing I did want to point out that's not in this note that, yes, she did buy slaves.
She did work with them in her field, which is noted in her other biography. Furthermore, before she died, she granted them freedom, and they stayed on her land as a part of her children's family. So, anyway, her name again is Marie Therese. If you Google it, it'll say coin, like two coins, but the proper pronunciation is Marie Therese Coakley. She was born in 1742 and died in 1816. And even though she was sleeping with the other, she got 68 acres worth of land for her time and trouble. Hey, if you don't give it up, you might as well get something in return. It's like eight. How long is the show today, Sate?
Well, the show is going to be on live stream for 7 more minutes, but we are going to keep going so we can try to get through all of these women. But each of us,
I think we should do like. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say like.
Okay.
I think it's important. Okay, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, sis.
Nah, because you already cut me off, so you might as well go ahead and continue.
That's messed up. All right, we can do maybe one or two more, and then we can go ahead and open the lines, or what were you going to suggest? Because we're going to go over. That's why I told everybody that if they're listening in the chat room and they have not called in, go ahead and call in. The number is 646-716-7675. I definitely want to get into some discussion about the sisters we've given information out about tonight, and kind of sort of after hearing this information, are any links being connected? What's popping up in the sisters' minds while they're listening to this information?
Okay, well, let's do two more. I want to definitely get to Dorothy Lavinia Brown, and I do want to do Dr. Jemison as well. And we can save the other sisters for the next installment.
So you want to do the next two?
Well, I mean, like, I want to do two more, so I don't know if I want to do two more. However, I just know that I want to do two more, like two sisters that I definitely want to talk about today.
All right. Let's see. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and do Mary McLeod Bethune. And let's see here. All right. Mary Jane McLeod Bethune was born July 10, 1875, and was an American educator and civil rights leader, best known for starting a school for black students in Daytona Beach, Florida, that eventually became the Bethune-Cookman University, and for being an advisor to President Franklin D. Roosevelt. This sister, this black woman, was an advisor to the president. Okay, back during that time frame, okay. Born in South Carolina to parents who had been slaves and having to work in the field at age five, she took an early interest in her own education. With the help of benefactors, Bethune attended college hoping to become a missionary in Africa. When that did not materialize, she started a school for black girls in Daytona Beach. Now, I need to stop there because when I did more research, I found out that she wanted to become a missionary in Africa, but she was told that they didn't need any black people to be missionaries in Africa, that they didn't need any more. That kind of pissed me off. Anyway, when that did not materialize, she started a school for black girls in Daytona Beach. From six students, it grew and merged with the Institute for Black Boys and eventually became the Bethune-Cookman School. Its quality far surpassed the standards of education for black students, and it rivaled those of white schools. Bethune worked tirelessly to ensure funding for the school and used it as a showcase for tourists and donors to exhibit what educated black people could do. She was president of the college from 1923 to 1942 and 1946 to 47, one of the few women in the world who served as a college president at that time. She was the only black woman that was serving as a college president at that time. Bethune was also active in women's clubs, and her leadership in them allowed her to become nationally prominent. She worked for the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932 and became a member of the Roosevelt's Black Cabinet, sharing the concerns of black people in the Roosevelt administration, while spreading Roosevelt's message to blacks who had been traditionally Republican voters. All right, I'm going to skip some information. I really don't want to cut this sister's achievement short. In October 1904, she rented a small house for $11 per month, making benches and desks out of discarded crates and obtaining items through charity. During this year, Bethune used $1.50 to start the Literary and Industrial Training School for Negro Girls in Daytona. She had six students, five girls age 6 to 12, and her son, Albert. Bethune chose Daytona because its economic opportunities held more possibilities than Palatka. Daytona had become a popular tourist destination. The school bordered Daytona's dump, and Bethune parents and church members raised money by making sweet potato pies, ice cream, and fried fish and selling them to construction crews. Ink for pens were made from elderberry juice, pencils from burned wood, and they scrounged local businesses for furniture. Bethune wrote later, "I considered cash money as smallest part of my resources. I had faith in a loving God, faith in myself, and a desire to serve." The school received donations of money, equipment, and labor from local black churches. Bethune also courted wealthy white organizations like the Ladies Palmetto Club and asked powerful white men to sit on the board of the school. These included James Gamble of Procter & Gamble and Thomas White of the White Sewing Machine. A 1912 visit from Booker T. Washington helped to impress upon her the importance of appealing to white benefactors. Bethune first gone to see Washington in 1896, was impressed by his clout with his donors. She later recalled a dream she had of Washington where he showed her a soiled handkerchief and pulled from it a large diamond and said, "Here, take this and build your school." I'm going to pause because, again, we have about 1 minute remaining in the live stream. Our call-in number is 646-716-7675. If you did not get in on the lines before this 1 minute is up, thank you for tuning in to listen to the show and, you know, share this link with everyone and make sure that you do not miss parts 2 and 3 to this series. In 1910, curriculum at the school started as rigorous Christian life, having girls rise at 5:30 a.m. for Bible study classes in home economics and other industrial skills such as dressmaking, millinery, cooking, and other crafts that emphasize a life of self-sufficiency. Students' days ended at 9 p.m. Soon, science and business courses were added, then high school courses of math, English, and foreign languages. In 1910, the enrollment of the school rose to 102, most of them being boarders. The success of this school was measured in its growing enrollment, addition of higher education courses, and the value of the school reaching $100,000 by 1923. The school merged with Cookman Institute for Men and became a co-ed. The value of school's 8 buildings was reassessed at $250,000. The curriculum of Bethune-Cookman School rivaled the segregated Daytona high schools. In contrast, the Daytona Colored Public Schools neglected to provide education past the 8th grade in the 1920s, until after the 1920s. An agent of General Education Board noted that Daytona is probably the best school for Negroes in Florida. National Council of Negro Women. Bethune founded the National Council of Negro Women in New York City in 1935, bringing together 28 different organizations to form a council to facilitate the improvement of quality of life for women and their communities. About the organization, Bethune stated, "It is our pledge to make a lasting contribution to all that is finest and best in America, to cherish and enrich the heritage and freedom of progress by working for the integration of all her people, regardless of race, creed, and national origin, into her spiritual, social, cultural, civic, and economic life, thus aid her to achieve the glorious destiny of a true and unfettered democracy." That's all I'm going to read for the present moment on Mary McLeod Bethune. That should get some people interested enough to go do some further research on her.
Okay. All right, the next one is Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown. Let's see what year. She was born January 7, 1919, and she passed away on June 13, 2004. Okay, I'm going to skip around a little bit, but I'm going to make it brief just so we can get this discussion in here. All right, her distinctions are Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown was the first African-American woman surgeon in the South. Furthermore, Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown was the first single woman in Tennessee to be granted the right to become an adoptive parent. Furthermore, Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown was also the first African-American woman to serve in the Tennessee state legislature. Okay, Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown spent her childhood in an orphanage and grew up to become the first African-American woman surgeon in the South, eventually being made chief of surgery at Nashville's Riverside Hospital. She was also the first African-American woman to be made a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. Dorothy Lavinia Brown was born in Philly in 1919. Soon after her birth, her mother, Edna Brown, moved to upstate New York and placed her in an orphanage there.
The predominantly white Troy Orphanage, later renamed Vander Heiden Hall, was her home from age 5 months until her 13th birthday when her mother reclaimed her. By that time, however, the orphanage seemed a safer home than the one her estranged mother could provide, so Dorothy ran away 5 times, returning each time to the orphanage. As a teen, she worked as a maid and at the Wing Sing Chinese Laundry. Determined to get an education, she finally ran away at age 15 to enroll in Troy High School. When the principal realized that she didn't have anywhere to stay, he arranged for a foster home with Laura and Samuel Wesley Redmond. They became a major influence throughout Dorothy Brown's life as a source of security, support, and enduring values. There were no other black women in general surgery in the South, and she had to forge through, oh wait, that's her quote, let me skip that. Brown's determination, beliefs, and values helped her to break through barriers in other aspects of her life, too. When a young unmarried patient implored the orphanage-raised physician to adopt her newborn daughter, Brown became the first adoptive mother in single mother in Tennessee in 1956. Then in 1966, when redistricting opened the door for a black candidate, Brown was asked to run for a seat in the state legislature. She ran and won, becoming the first black woman representative to the state legislature in Tennessee. Brown would later resign after the bitter defeat of an expanded abortion rights bill she had sponsored, frustrated in her belief that it had the potential to save the lives of many women in Tennessee. Let me skip to real quick her thing right here. Okay, we're going to rewind to her education. After finishing high school while working as a domestic helper, Brown attended Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina, receiving assistance from the Women's Division of Christian Service of a Methodist church in Troy in order to gain scholarship. Following college, she worked at the Rochester Army Ordnance Department in New York for 2 years. In 1941, she obtained her Bachelor of Arts degree and became an inspector for a defense plant in Troy. 1944, Brown began studying medicine at Meharry Medical College in Nashville, finishing her internship at Harlem Hospital in New York City. After graduating in 1948, she became a resident of Hubbard Hospital in Meharry in 1949, despite opposition to female surgeons and having convinced the then chief surgeon Matthew Walker. Brown completed her residency in 1954. Brown was the chief surgeon at the now defunct Riverside Hospital in Nashville from 1957 to 1983. In 1966, she became the first African-American female to be elected Tennessee General Assembly, known as the Tennessee State Legislature, a position she held for 2 years. She almost succeeded in having abortions legalized in cases of rape or incest and expanding the already existing legally permitted abortions in cases when the mother's life was in danger. In her career as a politician, Brown also became involved in the passing of the Negro History Act, which required public schools in Tennessee to conduct special programs during Negro History Week to recognize accomplishments made by African Americans.
I'm sorry, what year was that?
No. During her career, let's see, like 1966 to 1968, around that time. In 1968, Brown tried to obtain a seat in the Tennessee State Senate, but lost in part due for her support for the abortion laws. Also in 1968, following her departure from politics, Brown returned to becoming a full-time physician at the Riverside Hospital. Brown also acted as attending surgeon at the George W. Hubbard and General Hospitals as a director of education for clinical rotation program of the Riverside and Meharry Hospitals. She was also a surgery professor at Meharry Medical College. Let's see. Okay, she wrote autobiography essays and inspirational guides. In 1959, Brown became the third woman to become a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. In 1971, the Dorothy L. Brown Women's Residence at Meharry Medical College, Nashville, was named after her. She also received honorary doctorate degrees from Russell Sage College in Troy, New York, and also from Bennett College in Greensboro, South Carolina. In particular, she received her honorary degrees in the humanities from Bennett College and Cumberland University. Brown was a member of the Board of Trustees at Bennett College and of the Delta Sigma Theta sorority. She participated as speaker on panels that discussed scientific, religious, medical, and political issues.
Okay. I really want to read some more of these, but I don't want the switchboard to get hung up and me not able to open some
okay.
of the lines.
Okay.
So we're going to end it for now in terms of speaking, you know, reading the information, and we're going to open the lines so we can hear from some of the sisters. But before I open the lines, I have, if anyone is on the, has called in and you would like your line to be open, make sure that you press 1 on the switchboard so that I can see you on the switchboard, because right now I'm only seeing about 4 people on here, and I just want to make sure I get a chance to hear from everyone who may have a comment or question or want to participate with the remainder of the discussion. So, I want everybody to listen to this song right quick before I open the lines up. So just listen. Actually, I'm opening the lines up now. Just mute your phone lines out. I have 513, private call, and then 478. Mute your lines out while I play this song, because I don't want to have any issues after I play this song. But listen to the lyrics on this song and everything. This is Jill Scott. The name of this song is called How It Makes You Feel.
Lost with no one behind the steering wheel.
Okay, so y'all heard that song, Jill Scott, How I Make You Feel. All right, so I know we got Pastor Flowers on the line. How are you tonight?
I'm blessed. I couldn't get in the room all during the past 2.5 hours I've been on the phone, but this has been really good. And this is what I'm really trying to, you know, say to a lot of people. We don't know who we really are and what we've really done because they have hid these things for their agendas and not for our own agendas. And women have to start taking stock of these things and really just looking at what we have done. And it's always been single parents, but as you have spoken, you and Earth, there are many women who were single parents. That didn't, you know, dissuade them from doing all the things that they did. It's just really, I think that's what we need to hear more of, is what we've done and what we've contributed, and that it's okay to be a feminist, because you're female. That's what it is. And it's no shame in that, and how other people are using that to basically make you feel bad about what you are so they could use your power for what they want. I just think it's an excellent show.
It was going on what Pastor Flowers said. I have to admit, this is Sister Earth. Sister C can attribute to this, you know, especially about certain females in history. I thought black females, especially in history, I thought I knew even some of the lesser known ones. But when we really started to get into the research and how many of these women, like, I've never heard ever. I've never heard anything about. It was overwhelming. And then to see their accomplishments, and we're talking about, you know, we're not talking about antiquity. We're talking about our grandmamas, our great-grandmothers.
Right.
You know what I mean? We're talking about people who were slaves who became doctors when,
That's
you know,
right.
And all this other, you know, women who couldn't read and had $300,000 in the 1800s. I'm going to need
yeah.
that sister to come holler at me tonight in my dreams. I need some info. But
amen.
It was just really, I mean, I can say for myself, it was very, I mean, it was overwhelming. And at the same time, it was like I wanted to cry because, like, damn, this is all the stuff that we've done that we don't know about. Like, our role is so minimized.
That's
but then
right.
it was like a happy cry at the same time. Like, now we know we can give the sisters their proper due.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. And you know,
on that note, I know I mentioned it earlier in the show, but, you know, we did opening of the way, right, if you will, or ritual before the show. The sisters that participated with it, they know who they are. But, you know, I set the altar and everything up, you know, and the other things that were done during the ritual, what have you. The energy is so strong in this room right now. I cannot explain to you how that energy is. Those sisters are happy that we are speaking their names.
All right.
We got Goddess Networks on the line. Sister Kendra, how you doing?
I'm good. I don't have nothing to say.
yes, you do. You are out of be well of information.
Yeah, I'm just, I don't have nothing to say.
All right, we got Lynn on the line.
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
And we also have a private caller, 111 area code. Could you let us know who you are? Okay. All righty then.
Well, if they don't have anything to say, I do.
Go ahead, sis.
I want to thank you and Earth for bringing this information. This is so timely. You don't even understand. You know, with a new semester of school starting next week, and I'm getting a little worried. You know, I'm a single parent. I'm trying to work. I got all this going on. How am I supposed to go to school? How am I supposed to get a doctorate? I mean, am I really supposed to be doing all this? And then you sit and list name after name after name of these women who have gone through and faced a whole lot more than I'm facing. Mm-hmm. And not only did they get their doctorates, or maybe they were illiterate, but they learned more than could be taught in any college, and they did it all with both men and the white men on their backs and the threat of being killed just for their color.
Exactly.
So I'd be able to do twice as much in this day and age.
That's right.
I think what you said earlier, speak about what Shah Blessed said in the chat room, like, think about all the accomplishments these women did back then. Like, that means that, you know, the door is open for us. Like, going on to Lynn,
you know, girl, the sky's the limit. You can do it. Just like that, let me find that quote from Septima Clark. It was, what is this, the Septima Clark say?
Here's a great quote, something about, you know, as we go through, here we go.
It is good to remember, especially faced with life's challenges, that we stand on the shoulders of many great women who have gone before us and whose legacy gives us strength.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. It's just amazing. Y'all know we have the temple calls, and we have a different conversation on our temple calls. But I will say this. When I read that information about Ida B. Wells and her research on the lynching, I was floored. I mean, I read it over and over again. I was like, wait a minute. I know I'm not reading this wrong, but maybe I misinterpreted something wrong. And I mean, I knew what I was reading. I knew what I was reading, and I felt that it was right. But I almost was like, okay, no, this ain't what it say. I mean,
It's there, and I mean, obviously, you know. Anyway, it's there, and we know what it is and what it's not. And so I think another legacy that these women are giving us or have left us is that you got to do for self.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and this is, I'm not going to sit here and bash, you know, keep going with this. I ain't going to bash them, because what I realized is like, we just got to focus on what it is for us and what we need to do. I'm not saying, you know, some of them, you know, smell good and look nice, you know what I'm saying, do your thing, but just remember, it's about you. The same thing that talk to them, that they always do for self first above any other, you have to start looking at it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, take care of you first. And I don't care if people say, oh, that's selfish. No, it's not selfish. How can you do anything for anybody else unless you and your soul and your body and your mind is right? You can't do nothing
that's
for nobody
right.
else.
That's correct.
Another thing that stuck out to me, going back, I'm sorry, real quick, just to say, another thing that stuck out with me with all of these women, regardless of what they did or, you know, what their career fields were or whatever, but another major theme that always came up, and it kind of goes with this Ida B. Wells thing, is a lot of these women were also focused on the rights and the health of women. Like, it's real funny. Even some of the sisters that we know that we're going to get into in another segment, another show,
yeah.
who we know for, you know, power to the people with the afros and all that other stuff, once you get into their body of work, they, after a certain period, it seemed like they almost specifically just started focusing on women's rights. Women's rights. You know what I mean? It's just really funny. And even the sisters like Septima Clark, who in the 20s she was fighting for women's rights. So,
right. You have a lot of women from the 1700s and the 1800s who were focusing on women's rights too. The thing that stood out to me in doing this research was that it's like, okay, so for them to say that women weren't the excuse that I hear. And I keep having to refer to the conscious movement because it's a lot of BS being told to these women, and they're not being, pushed to go research their history. They're just being pushed to research the books that they put out on these reading lists and research the people that they want them to research. But see, this is the thing. The thing that stood out overwhelming to me was that it was a whole lot of poor black single women. And then you have to connect that with the research Ida B. Wells did.
and I mean, some of the other things that they say. But then also some of the other things that they say, like, oh, well, there's one video from, quote, an elder male who is like, look at, you know, everything is screwed up because look at the past two generations have been raised by women. And I'm about to swagger jack your words. See, name a generation that hasn't almost been exclusively raised by women. Let me know.
Name it.
Riddle me that, Batman.
I bet the man that said that probably was raised by his mother.
Probably. Probably exclusively. And another thing that also stood out to me as well is this, and this goes back to the whole conscious thing. And some of the sisters we did not touch on. Now, I'll use Septima Clark as an example. Again, you know, when we're taught, even by our own people, about civil rights or liberation, whatever, you know, there's certain names, you know, Martin Luther King or Huey Newton, always that. The funny thing is, once you get deeper into the research, you find out that they were really showpieces. They were like the mouthpieces. The sisters were the ones who actively organized these groups. And I'm going to use Kathleen Cleaver as an example. Kathleen Cleaver did not have the greatest relationship with Eldridge. She stuck with him for a long time, but she didn't want to blow his spot up. However, her son kind of blew his spot up. And he is very she said it herself. She said Eldridge Cleaver was very unorganized. However, he would have these ideas, and if she thought it was like an idea that was worth getting into, she did all the legwork. She organized it. She built it from the ground up. When he got kicked out of the Black Panthers and they started their own thing, it was solely off of her blood, sweat, and tears while he was overseas about to become a Mormon. So, anyway, once we get into those females and really what they did, it's amazing to me to find out this information. At the same token, it's disappointing that we're always force-fed just what the brothers did. And that's not to minimize what they did do, you know what I mean? You know, their contributions were great, but what about the sisters?
The other thing that is... The other thing that happens is every time a sister brings up something about her womanhood or about this is how women are treated or from a women's standpoint or I want to do this for women or I want to go study, what about the brothers? What about the brothers? Why is it that every time, well, we already know the answer to this, so I'm gonna just say this. I get tired of people. I'm past the point where I give a fuck about what other people say about me or names they might call me. Who gives a shit about that? But I really get tired of hearing, you know, somebody always trying to impose something about, you know, Black men when we're trying to do research on our own about us. I'm tired of hearing that shit. Don't come to me with it. I don't want to hear it. Because at this point, you have been the proponent, and whoever it is that I'm talking to that's getting serious and getting sick in their stomach about this comment, I'm talking to you. You have been the proponent of us studying history, except you have been the person giving us the books to study, okay? So it's okay for us to study what you want us to study. We ain't supposed to be thinking on our own. We really ain't supposed to be reading because we might get beers. Well, guess what? It's called a tweezer and a fucking wax machine, okay?
Hey, I'm sexy with my beard. They still look at me with my beard. They love it. Hey, girl, they love that 5 p.m. shadow. They love it.
Oh, my God.
They love it.
Hey, and then you got to ask yourself, why do they like it? But that's for another show. So anyway,
you know what?
All I got to say is the sisters need to pull up Ife Amadiume. That was one of the sisters I was gonna talk about, and I'm gonna save her for another show because I don't want to address that at the present moment. I get tired of these brothers talking about that there is no. I'm gonna go ahead and say it. Get mad if you want. Email me if you want. But since y'all talk about scholarship and history, here's a piece of scholarship for your ass. There's too much literature out there about homosexuality in the continent of Africa and homosexuality within Islam and the Muslim
teach
community.
It.
Don't talk to me about that bullshit.
Teach.
Oh, want scholarship. You don't want me to publicize a book list of information that would probably, you know, blow the hole out. You know what I'm saying? It's not for the purpose of trying to embarrass nobody or prove nobody wrong. What I am saying, sisters, is if it's something that you have a question about, it's a reason you have a question about it. And brothers, too, go research it on your own. Don't take nobody's word for it. Don't take my word for it. Prove the information and the scholarship I gave you tonight wrong. Prove me wrong. Show me where these women were awesome and didn't do what the hell they did. Show me better than you can tell me.
See, the thing is, sis, they already know.
Right.
They know.
You the ones
stuff,
that don't know.
Thank you, Mother. We the ones don't know. They always
that's
know.
That's how they got the power to get you down.
Right. They know. Thank you. And that's what they're using. That's why they're calling you lesbian and dyke and slut and whore and feminist, because they're using fear so that you won't
that's
go
right.
that way. They already
and
have.
I will.
Okay, well, let me pause.
Like
let me pause right there then.
Like Saru was saying in the class, I mean in the chat room, she was just amazed because to her some of it is common knowledge, but to a lot of women that were fearful of that term, feminist, they don't know. But the men have always. You think you don't want to came across this stuff? Girl, them men, just like in that conscious B-boy site that y'all found, them men have always known this stuff. We just didn't know it.
Plus, they're doing what we don't know they're doing. Like I said, bros before holes. They've been doing this for a long time, and it's always been there. But you didn't know it. And that fear and stuff that they put in us, listen, women, we should get off the religion thing because we everywhere and we all things.
Thank
we
you.
Can do anything that we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
We the bitch, the witch, whatever they want. We are faggot, whatever the heck. Thank you. Thank you.
That's what
but you won't be holding me down because we the ones that make life roll. And nobody
all
else do.
Is, I've said this before. I've said this before on another show. The show that is, what's the name of the show? My Sons or something like that. Get mad if you want to, but you need to do the research. Since y'all are a proponent of scholarship, get the scholarship on it. Ask some of your brothers. They got it. They just ain't telling you. They telling you these things don't exist, but they selling these damn books on their website. Use some common sense. I ain't going to even call no names. So, men are degenerate women.
Yes.
So if you look at all of this, everybody is a damn woman.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody on the planet, except one of the women who are degenerate, which they call men, are barren. They cannot reproduce. I'm not even going to go further than that. I'm not going to go further than that because there are classes you can sign up for if you really are interested in studying and getting into this information. There's also, you can join the temple. These types of conversations and the documentation and all of that is available. If you study nature, you will find that to be true. Women were here alone by themselves for at least 150,000 years before men were. These brothers know this information. They're not giving it to you, and the question is why? And what is it that they're hiding, and why are they hiding it? And the thing is, the information is not, this is the kicker. This information is not in hiding. It's just that the fear tactic of being called, you know, this, that, and the third because of what you're researching, you won't even go into Google and Google these things. The information is right there. This information is all over the place, in books, in blogs, everything. You know, Sarood, I saw what you put in there. I'm just so sick and tired of people lying and acting like they know all this information. They do know it, but they teaching the opposite of what they know because they afraid of what women are going to find out about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question becomes, well, you know, they think that we're going to retaliate against them for all the things they've done to us.
I don't
question
even
mark.
Think it's really so much of that. They're not worried about retaliation. They're worried about control. And once they lose that control, all hell. I mean, that's what they don't want
to
lose.
Retaliation
and that
goes to the
book.
They don't want to lose the control.
That goes back to that book we are studying in our study group in the temple,
Yes. Man's greatest fear.
Yes.
We are studying man's greatest fear. That's all I'm going to say. When you get into that book, and this ain't about bashing nobody, it just is what it is. When you get into that book and you look at the historical facts and the statistics and how of everything, you cannot deny solid facts right in front of your face.
Psychological evidence.
You
well,
can't
I
deny
am a
bastard.
I don't have no problem saying. For me,
no,
it is.
You know what? I don't have to
they
be a bastard. They can label me whatever they want. I'm past the label, so I don't give a fuck what they call me.
Yeah, because I damn sure don't. I am going to
bash it. Because it just is what it
and
is.
And I'm going to talk about it, and I don't give a damn what none of them say. They already call me all types of names anyway. But the positive thing is that, and I told you all in that interview I did with you all, it's different when the black feminists get it because they've known, you know, this stuff forever. But they still give honor to a male supreme god. So the power is still stifled. But when, I just hate to use this term, but when conscious or enlightened sisters who know that God, the basis of all the supreme being is feminine, when you all get a hold of it, it's going to be completely different. It'll be what the feminists did times the 100th power.
Because at that point, you're tapping into your true essence. The original essence on this planet and in the cosmos is a black womb, hence black womb-niverse.
Yep.
It is a black womb. Black woman, you are the beginning and the essential of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I heard a man make this comment. Now, I have yet to confirm it, but because I am that I am, it's probably true. But the comment that was made was by Dr. Avin Van Sertima, if I'm not mistaken. And, Kendra, you'll be able to verify me on this. He said that the black woman entails every element on the periodic table within her body. Tell me who you are. Tell me who God is.
That's
tell
where
me who
chemistry
God
came
is.
From.
Okay?
Yes, yes.
Yep.
She's handling it.
So you cannot sit here, not the black man, not a white woman. The black woman has every element on the periodic table and probably some that have not even been, found
discovered.
Yet. She is the essential element. She is the fifth element. She is non-ether. She is God.
Remember, even in that movie, I think the movie is the fifth element. None of the elements came together until that woman was sitting in the middle.
That's why I said that.
Yep. You're right.
She always been God and didn't know it.
Going back to the women that we spoke on tonight, that's one of the things that even though, you know, our sources aren't necessarily telling us this, but one of the things that shouted to me, especially some of the sisters that I really, like, admired and some of the things that they did as single women or whatever. Even women, even, like, Dr. Lena Edwards, who left her husband, like, nigga, I got stuff to do. But the thing that always the thing that always came to me, it with certain females, of course, is the fact that that's, in essence, what they were saying. And that was the voice from 100 years ago or 50 years ago or whatever, that these women, just by their accomplishments and some of the things they did by themselves, are almost saying, like, I am God. And one of the sisters,
I think it was Septima Clark, where she was saying, like,
her mother was, you know, from South Carolina but was raised in Haiti. And then one of the things they also went into mention was like, oh, well, she was a quiet Christian. Like, I've never heard that term before. But anyway, a quiet Christian, but her mom was from Haiti. However, anyway, my point is it seemed to me reading about these different sisters and accomplishments they made is the fact that, in essence, they knew what we're talking about now. Like, they might not have proof or biblical scholarship, but something in them was like, I am God. I will create my own destiny for me and my children. Biddy Mason, and the thing that stood out to me for Biddy Mason was the fact that unlike anybody else I can remember, male especially, she created a legacy for her extended family to live
yes.
off of for generations. Right. And she couldn't read.
Yes, she couldn't
she
read.
She walked
1,700 miles. 1,700 miles. With three children and then had to do stuff for some man. I mean, these women knew they were God.
They knew it.
That's
just
it.
Like Madam C.J. Walker, when she married her second husband and she wanted to expand her business, he was trying to talk her out of it, and she was like, you know what? We need a divorce. She was like, I got stuff to do. You cool. You cute. You know, sex might be good, but either you're going to be with me or you're not. So you trying to hold me back, I got to let go of some baggage.
And, hey, we didn't touch on her yet. She's going to be for another show. But another thing that I dug about Sister Asada Shakur was she was married back in the day. And they were both, you know, into the liberation movement and stuff like that. But she said, and now mind you, in her autobiography, she only gave a paragraph worth of mention to her marriage. But what she said was they had separated because of the differences in belief of gender roles.
Yes.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Hold on, Earth. You said that she said they separated because of that.
Mm-hmm. A belief in gender roles, yeah.
You know what's so interesting about that? Because I see so many big ups to this sister, but they never talk about this particular one, what you just said. And
right.
I also find it interesting, and this is the tie, in my estimation, that binds a lot of these women and some of the women that y'all haven't mentioned, that all of them were fighters for the cause. But in the end, the cause
uh-huh.
for women always trumped out. They
exactly.
always ended up knowing that there's something about this gender. It's something about me as a woman.
Yes.
And another interesting thing going to Asada is when she was in prison, before she broke out of jail, her grandmother and her family came to visit her, and her grandmother told her, and her whole family was excited. She was like, what's going on with y'all? And her grandmother said, I had a dream. And she was like, a dream? And then she went on to explain about how her grandmother used to have visions. And her grandmother said,
I don't know when it's going to happen or whatever, but you're going to get out of here, and you're going to be free. And she was like, you saw this in a dream? She was like, yeah, I saw it in a dream. And
yes,
less than two or three months later, she was out of jail.
My Lord.
Briefly, before anybody says anything else, someone may have their computers on, your speakers on. Can you turn them down or either mute your line out? Because we're still playing. Somehow, I upgraded on Blog Talk Radio, and we're still live. People can't call into the line now, but it's still playing. Like, if you got the chat room up, the show is still streaming.
Mhm.
But yeah, it's just amazing how a lot of these women that were in the same time period, all of these women that were movers and shakers, they knew each other. They were involved in some of the same organizations. They were very organized. And the funny thing is that organization is going to come in the forefront with the next show, because I think on the next show, because of this particular conversation, I think our next show, the next series, we need to focus on the women in the movement, in the Black Liberation Movement, and how they felt, you know, what were their accomplishments, how they started out, and where they ended up, and how they were treated, because it's not a big contrast as to how they were treated then versus how they're treated now.
Mm-hmm. On a side note, it's really funny.
They're not told to go study those women.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there'll be brief little blurbs about them,
right,
but not necessarily their whole contribution. Just as a funny, the funny thing to me, especially, I'll be specific, especially with women who were most, like, tied to, like, the Black Liberation Movement with the Panthers or whatever, or the the student nonviolence, that one. It's so funny how a lot of them ended up lesbians.
Wait a minute now. I didn't know
I didn't want. We won't go touch on that to the next show. But every woman that started out with like Black Panther Party or the Black Liberation Movement, every last one of them ended up being lesbian.
Not every last one of them.
But,
like I said, Kendra, once I started, like,
doing more research on some of the prominent sisters that we know in the Black Liberation Movement or whatever, you know, a lot of them had boyfriends or were romantically tied to other people in the movement. But the funny thing is, later in life, you know, you look 10, 20 years later, all of a sudden they're lesbians. So, anyway, I still like men. I was like, with all this information, am I going to turn into a lesbian?
And that's what they want.
What the hell?
Listen,
we were
listen.
Just looking because I was like, what the hell? So you mean all these women that know shit end up? I was like, what in the hell?
Now that's
is going
what they
on
were
here
anyway.
Like, what is
this to know that I don't know? Anyway, it's very interesting, but their contributions.
Yes, we won't get into that. This is very good.
Yes.
You are silly.
They touched it.
You are.
They don't want you to know these things because they do want you to believe, oh, you're going to turn out. I mean, but what it is individuality. You could be what you want to be.
Yeah, but see, you know what I'm thinking? And think about this, mother.
Some of them,
even in this society, when you think about it, even in this society, we are, and I'm heterosexual, but even in this society, we are conditioned to like men.
That's
right. From a little baby, she's pushed to be domesticated, to be a lover of men. So some of them women were probably, you know, lesbian anyway. They were just pushed in this society to like men, when a lot of them probably really liked women in the first place.
I think when women begin to understand who they are, they'll determine what they want to be. Because a lot of us have been, you know, conditioned to be something that we're not. When you become who you are, that's when we're going to become bad. We bad already. But when you know who you are and you don't care what the hell somebody say you are, that's when it's going to work. It's going to work good. Because we must know who we are. We could be anything.
Yep.
Anything we want to be.
This is the thing. Sex is great, but if a man does not understand and respect me, I'm not going to bow down to him just for some penis.
No woman ever posts a bow.
I'm not going to do that. You know, if he can respect me, he may not necessarily know all the things that I know, but if he can respect me and treat me with honor, that's on a different level. But I'm not going to be subjected to you. I'm not going to be less than you because I know who I am and I'm standing strong and I'm walking tall in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I got big shoes to fill. You know, these women that were doing all these things and entrepreneurs and first millionaire and the first woman in California to own real estate, first doctors, first surgeons. I mean, what?
Another thing I want to touch on that kind of has to go with the men is
What's her name? Marie-Therese Colquitt. Like if we pointed her out in certain, especially conscious circles, they would immediately shun her for messing with the white dude or whatever. And, like, don't get me wrong, the white dudes are not necessarily my cup of tea. I can't wrap my mind around that. However, homegirl messed with this tape, but wait, let me finish. Dang, you still stealing people's thunder. Damn. Anyway, homegirl messed with this man for all this time, and yes, he did marry a white woman. However, a part of their breakup, homegirl got 68 acres of land. It's like, okay,
you
listen,
it ain't
if
free.
If I'm going to let the cat out or whatever, don't you think I deserve 68 acres of land, regardless of what color the man is? It's like, out of all of the sisters that I've researched back in the day, their husbands didn't leave them 68 acres.
They didn't
leave
them 68 cents. Hell.
Yes.
They didn't even get 68 cents.
Half of the men didn't have a whole lot to leave in terms of the legacy. The women had the legacy to leave.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying some of these women's husbands didn't have. Some of them did have something, and they built things together. But the thing that I felt, the common thread that I'm seeing, is that most of the time, either these women became widows at young age and they never remarried, or they remarried and then got divorced, or they just outlived all of their husbands, or, you know, they just were single.
Mm-hmm.
I'll use an example from my own family that's passed down. Now, in North Carolina, I think it's my great-great.
I can't tell you which. No, I'm not talking about the pink house seat. I'll save that for a hetero conversation. Okay, but my great-great, one of them, I don't know. Anyway, when they freed the slaves or whatever, the slave owner left so much land to my great-great-grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why, I guess, is because he was his child, really. Anywho,
right.
So anyway, and so he left so much land to him. And a part of his skill was he was a blacksmith. And so he married my great-great-grandmother, a black woman, 100% black woman or whatever. And what she did was teach him how to hustle. And what I mean by this, he had land, but he also had a skill. So when people would come in the community and need, I don't know, shoes for their horses or whatever they needed his services for, but say they didn't have all the money, what she would do is set up like, okay, you need this. Well, this is what you're going to do. You're going to sign over like a temporary hold. She was doing the payday loan before we even knew what a payday loan was. So you sign over so much of your land and we'll hold it. And then when you pay us, you can get it back. But if you don't pay us, we're going to keep it. And so by this way, they not only amassed a fortune, but they also had, I mean, by the time that her husband died first, by the time her husband died, she had something like 200, 300 acres in North Carolina herself. Matter of fact, some of that land is still in our property, and some of our family members are still buried on this land. And so even though he originally got the land, she's the one who taught him how to hustle. She taught him how to do the payday loan, and so she made him wealthy. So, you know, women are awesome. Women have always been the business sense, the business mind. We have always been that. And just like we're researching these women, even the women that we're going to get into in other series who were linked to famous men, once you start digging, you realize that she was the brains of the operation.
That's
she was the organizer. She was the one who kept this fool from self-destructing.
That's right. That's it.
I mean, she's an awesome person, the black woman.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, once she realizes who she is and accepts who she is, that is when she can do and be all things.
She better take that back, because that's what we're going to need to make it through.
Well, on that note, Pastor Flowers... Woo! I thoroughly enjoyed the show tonight. I have, you know, been educated through sharing this information and researching this information. Definitely want to give thanks to Sister Earth for assisting me with researching and giving me the names of some sisters that I never heard of. And we both just went on. I mean, it's been an honor to kick this series off and to continue with it. So the next time we do it, we'll probably do another video possibly to promote it on YouTube or whatever. But Everybody who's listening, just make sure you mark us a favorite, Black Womaniverse, as a favorite on Blog Talk. And any sisters who are interested in joining the temple, please make sure that you visit us at blackwombaniverse.com. And our email address is blackwomb@divinechemistry.com. And chemistry is spelled K-H-E-M-E-S-T-R-Y. Make sure you visit our sponsors and our websites, and that is mocha-mango.com and divinechemistry.com. Peace.
Peace.
Excellent show.